All right.
Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink a beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key. Or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away. But I feel alright. I feel alright tonight. I feel alright tonight. And I'll bring you precious contraband and ancient tales from distant lands.
Right. How you doing, everybody? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, as I am every weekday morning. I'm your overnight dude, Monday through Friday, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich follows this show with the opening bell at 5 and 6 o'clock. You got the great Steve Cochran with the morning drive. And there you go. So welcome back, everybody. And we're here. It's a Thursday night, Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. It's one artist, three songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Coming up on the show, we're getting close to Halloween, so we'll do a few Halloween topics this morning. But we are welcoming to the show, once again, one of my favorite guests. After the 1:30 news, the great Joe Bob Briggs is going to join us, the king of the drive-in, great movie reviewer, a legend who's been doing and reviewing movies and hosting TV shows for years and years and years. He's just the best. And he's got a new show called Joe Bob Briggs Halloween Hootenanny. And and it's going to be on tomorrow night, Friday the 25th, on Shudder, and it'll be 8 p.m. Central. It'll drop, and it's Joe Bob Briggs' Halloween Hootenanny. He's going to host a triple feature, and it's going to stream live starting at 8 o'clock tomorrow night, and he'll tell us all about it and talk about the preparing season 2 of The Last Drive-In, which is a great show as well. So yeah, Joe Bob Briggs, he's just the best. You all know Joe Bob Briggs. So he's going to join us in this Halloween time. And speaking of Halloween, you know, we always talk about really scary movies at this time of year. So I actually looked up what is considered the least scary movies of all time, because we always talk about the very scary stuff, but the least scary movies of all time. So we'll get into that, and we want to hear from you guys. This is Complex Magazine put together this article, and they picked out 50 movies that they consider the least scary movies of all time. So we will get into that. We're going to talk about sketch comedy this morning. I've checked out an article, which, you know, I mean, if you know that I love sketch comedy, and I'm one of the biggest SNL fans, and particularly in the world. I watch it every Saturday night. I DVR it every week, and I've been watching Saturday Night Live since 1975, since the very first episode. The Washington Post put together an article talking about the 20 defining comedy sketches of the past 20 years. And it's not just from SNL, it's from sketch comedy shows that are all over the dial. So these they consider some of the defining comedy sketches of the past 20 years. What do you guys think? What are some of your favorite sketches from TV shows? SNL included, obviously, but it's not just SNL. It's all the comedy shows that have sketches. What are some of the best of all time? So we'll talk about that. And our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Stay connected on our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/Nick D Show. It's interactive. It's constantly updated. You should like us and follow us right now. facebook.com/Nick D Show. And subscribe to our podcasts. Every single second of every single show is podcast. And I know a lot of people listen to our podcast, and we appreciate that. So subscribe yourself. And you can just go to iTunes. You check out all of our podcasts at WGNRadio.com. But check out iTunes. Subscribe anywhere you get your podcast. It's free. It'll automatically be sent to your device, and you can listen at your leisure, bro. So check out our podcasts as well. All right, so that's what's coming up on the show. Again, Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. We'll play them later. It's one artist, three songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. My regular producer, Tom Hush, is off this morning, so filling in is our good friend Ben. Ben, how are you?
I'm really torn right now.
Why is that?
Because Major League Baseball is toying with my life.
Why is that?
Well, one, Masked Singer was preempted tonight.
Oh, yes. The Masked Singer was preempted. Yep. Yes.
So I was a little upset about that one, not being able to watch before coming in. And I'm excited, but I want the official news of the new Cubs manager that we have coming.
Yeah. They can't announce it on a World Series day.
Yeah.
On a game day. So, well, I mean, everybody already kind of knows. They broke the story. David Ross is going to be the new manager of the Chicago Cubs. And I'm fine with that. I would have preferred Girardi, you know, because he actually has experience as a manager, has gone to the World Series. Yeah. But people love Ross. He knows a lot of the guys on this team. He's very good friends with them, which might be interesting to see now that he's like the boss.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he went to the World Series, been to the World Series twice, won two World Series, one with the Red Sox, one with the Cubs. So he's got that experience too, but he's never coached. He's never managed. So, but I'm happy about it. I'm happy. I think the team is going to be happy with it. And, you know, he's got to earn experience somehow.
Yeah.
So,
and everybody's been talking about, you know, there are a few examples of first year managers that have gone to the World Series.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens. I happen to be a really big fan of Joe Girardi.
Okay.
I loved him when he was on the Cubs. I think the guy was he was a great player and a great manager. And I just happen, I'm a big Joe Girardi fan. And so I was kind of rooting for him to take it. But, you know, I'm happy that, I'm just happy the Cubs have a manager, at all.
Yeah,
you know, and the fact that the team really likes him, Theo really likes him. And he's got a great history with the Cubs. Everybody loves him, and the fans are happy. Clearly, judging by my news feed, the fans seem to be very happy with the choice. I'm happy too. My first choice was Girardi.
Okay.
So, but anyway, the official announcement's going to come in about 12 hours. It's only a matter because they couldn't do it. Man, how about those Nationals?
Holy, what was it, 12-3
12
tonight?
12-3.
That was ridiculous.
Yeah. And my friends are posting on Facebook and social media, hey, it looks like the Expos are going to win the World Series. Because, of course, the Nationals used to be the Montreal Expos. So, but yeah, wow, they just are killing it, man. It's ridiculous.
I might misplace this stat, but somebody was saying this was the first intentional walk the Astros have done all year.
Oh, I don't know. I didn't know that.
They walked Soto.
Yeah. I didn't know it was the first intentional walk.
Yeah, that's why I heard mentioned from another media source.
Okay. Well, I'm rooting for the Nationals anyway.
I am too.
One, it's National League. Yep. So that I'm a National League guy. Two, it's their first time to the World Series, man. And they're considered the underdogs. You know, so yeah, no, I was happy about it. So anyway, all right. So sports are happening right now, and Tom will be back tomorrow. Ben, thank you for filling in.
Absolutely.
And in the newsroom is Vic Vaughn. Vic, how are you?
Morning, sir.
Morning. So it's Thursday.
It is Thursday all day long.
All day long, all day and all night.
That's right.
So that's usually what happens in a 24-hour period. 24-hour period. So I know you didn't get to see any of the game. The World Series, but the Nats look pretty ridiculous at this point.
You said it all, 12-3.
12-3.
I got to catch at least one of these games. I'll have to stay up one of these nights to watch one just to say I saw some of it. Yeah. I haven't watched any of it yet.
Yeah.
It's right in the middle of my sleep cycle.
It is for me too, but I like even when I don't have a horse in the race, I like watching the World Series.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's the World Series.
Yeah,
you know?
sure.
I got to, speaking of sports, you know, I noticed I've been watching, you know, sports and like on the 10 o'clock news and stuff over the past few weeks and, you know, here and there. And let me talk about Trubisky for a second here for the Bears.
Yeah.
I kind of feel bad for the guy because, you know, everybody on the local news, they have to fill their sports segment with something. So it's a week of just nonstop jabbing at this guy. You know what I mean? You have to wait a week between games.
I know.
And in that time, it's analyzing the Bears and ripping the Bears apart and Trubisky and all this other stuff. And I gotta say, I feel bad for like NFL teams or players that are having a rough go of it because they're in the news cycle every night for a week.
Yeah, I don't feel bad for them. They make too much money. And you know what? Right? I mean, you could take a little heat when you're making that much
money. Yeah. It's just
and he deserves the heat, right?
No, I agree. I just think that, you know, the cycle for football is just so different than any other sport.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and they got what, 16 games in a season.
Exactly.
Only 16 games.
Only 16 games.
I mean, if you're 0-3, you're pretty much there's almost no chance. Your season's almost over.
Right.
Not all the way over, but it's close.
But what goes on in between the games is a week worth of analysis, over-analysis, slamming, opinion here, opinion there. You know, and as, you know, the players, I would imagine, like, the football players are like, look, I can't listen to this stuff every single day between games. It's 7 days worth of this stuff.
I think they even have said, Trubisky himself has said, they don't even look at it or listen to it.
I wouldn't
block it out. Some of them don't even look at, you know, after a loss, even look at their social media accounts.
Because like in hockey, you got maybe two days between games. Okay. And it's a long season, so the analysis isn't going to be as intense. And the same thing with baseball. You got a game every day almost.
Wait until this Sunday.
Yeah.
Because they're going to host the Chargers, who are 2-5.
Right.
If they lose to the Chargers, you wait and see what heat comes down on them.
See, that's when you got to listen to Hampo being Cause.
Yeah, for therapy.
Because it's the, but not just for therapy, because they're going
to. I listen to it for therapy after a loss.
They're going
to
go nuts and flip tables. That really is one of the most entertaining shows on this radio station.
It is, yeah. And they've been doing it for a long time. Even before here, it's been, you know, with, who was it? OB and, can't remember, but yeah, I've been listening to him for a long time.
It's just great stuff. It's really entertaining, and again, I always root for the Bears, and I hope the Bears win. But that show is more entertaining when they lose.
It is.
It's hilarious when they go nuts and start screaming.
If you get angry after a Bears loss, which most fans do, most Bears fans do, I think it's therapy. Listen to those guys.
You know what? I guess that makes sense. Sure. That does make sense. Well, anyway, we'll see. I was just noticing that, you know, last night when I was watching, you know, the 10 o'clock news and the sports report, I was like, well, these guys have to listen to this for 7 days between each game.
Right.
It just seems crazy. All right, let's take a break. Now, we're talking about scary stuff tonight. The great Joe Bob Briggs, drive-in king and horror movie aficionado, is going to be joining us after the 1:30 news, and we're going to be talking about the least scary movies. But I believe I have a story about what might be what might turn out to be the scariest movie of all time. The most terrifying film of all time. And I'll tell you all about it after the break. All right, everybody, welcome back. It's Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. One artist, three songs, get your requests in now. We'll play them later, 312-981-7200. Coming up after the 1:30 news, the great Joe Bob Briggs is going to join us, king of the drive-in. His new show, his special event, is called Joe Bob Briggs Halloween Hootenanny, and you can see it on Shudder streaming service. It drops tomorrow night, Friday, October 25th at 8 p.m. Central Time. It's a triple feature horror movie, Hootenanny, with lots of other stuff thrown in. And it's always great to have Joe Bob on, especially this time of year. So Joe Bob Briggs joining us after the news at 1:30. We're also going to talk about the least scariest movies of all time. And we always talk about horror movies at this time of year and some of the scariest ones. What are your favorites? But you know, we're going to pull a reversal this morning and a little bit later talk about the least scary horror movies. Ones that disappointed you that you thought were going to be really scary and nah, didn't work. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. 312-981-7200. Okay, speaking of scary movies, I have a story here that, in my opinion, represents what it might be the scariest movie that will ever be made, ever. Prepare yourself, because this is going to be the most terrifying film ever. This is what the headline reads, and this is from MSN.com. The headline reads, Barney the Purple Dinosaur movie is in the works from Mattel and Daniel Kaluuya.
Get out.
That's what I'm reading. So that's why I say it's going to be the most terrifying movie ever made.
I thought he went extinct with the rest of them.
I don't know.
Oh, man.
And I don't know what's going on with Daniel Kaluuya. I don't have no idea. He's executive producing it. I don't know.
Wow.
Why? Someone wake up Baby Bop, it says. Barney the Purple Dinosaur is getting his own movie thanks to a collaboration between Mattel Films and Daniel Kaluuya. The live-action project will mark the first collaboration between Mattel Films, Valparaiso Pictures, and Get Out star Kaluuya's 59% production. There's going to be... He'll have an executive producer. Kaluuya will have an executive producer credit on it. Adam Paulson, Bobby Hoppe, and Kevin McCann of Mattel Films will also have credits on it. And they're doing it. They're doing a live-action Barney the Purple Dinosaur movie. Working with Daniel Kaluuya will enable us to take a completely new approach to Barney that will surprise audiences and subvert expectations, Robert Brenner of Mattel Films said in a Friday announcement. The project will speak to the nostalgia of the brand in a way that will resonate with adults while entertaining today's kids. Barney was a ubiquitous figure for many childhoods. Then he disappeared into the shadows, left misunderstood, Kaluuya said. We're excited to explore the compelling modern-day hero to see if his message of I love you, you love me can stand the test of time. You gotta be kidding me. I can't believe this is a thing. Barney is a dinosaur from our imagination. And we can't wait to get I Love You, You Love Me stuck in our heads everywhere yet again, David Carrico of Valparaiso Pictures said. TV series Barney and Friends ran for 13 seasons, and it premiered in 1992. The show's theme song, which readers can remember via a video that was posted with this article, was permanently stuck in parents' heads for the duration of that tenure and probably longer. The big screen adaptation won't alleviate that. Barney will join other Mattel film projects in development. So get this. These are actual movies that are in development at Mattel Pictures. And I didn't even know Mattel Films was a thing. I didn't know, you know, the Mattel toy company had like a film production unit, a studio. I had no idea. So Barney's going to be the first one out of the gate. And here are the other projects that that are in development with Mattel Films. Barbie. Hot Wheels. They're going to make a Hot Wheels movie. Masters of the Universe. I'm going to try that again, this time without Dolph Lundgren, I guess. American Girl is another one that they're looking at. All right, now what about this one? Viewmaster.
How are they going to do that?
How are you going to make a movie out of the Viewmaster? Is it going to be a magical Viewmaster? Kids get it and they can press the little button down and end up in a different world? I don't know. How about this one? The Magic 8-Ball. That's a film project that's in development at Mattel Films right now. The Magic 8-Ball.
I mean, I feel like that could be turned into a great horror movie.
Finally, Major Matt Mason.
Okay.
So those are all in development. But anyway, the scariest movie ever made is in development right now, and it's being made, and it's Barney, the Purple Dinosaur. He's going to be back. I can't wait till they make the Baby Shark Baby Shark into a movie. So, all right, let's break, because the news is coming up next. Prepare yourself for Barney the movie, everybody. Joe Bob Briggs will join us, and we'll talk about his Hootenanny right after we break for the news. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here on a Thursday morning. Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. It's 1 hour, it's three songs, 312-981-7200. That's coming up. We are going to talk about the least scary movies of all time and some of the most important sketch comedy comedy sketches of all time. For everywhere from Saturday Night Live to Key and Peele to all the sketch comedy shows from the past, some of the most important and landmark pieces of sketch comedy. So that's all coming up. As you know, it is the month of October. It is getting close to Halloween, and I personally couldn't be happier. It's my favorite time of year. It's my favorite holiday. I love horror movies. They're my favorite genre. And so we're really pleased to bring back one of my favorite guests that I've interviewed, and we had him on not too long ago, and we're getting him back on now. Joe Bob Briggs, who is he's a host, he's the king of the drive-in. You can check out at the real Joe Bob for Twitter. And coming up on Friday night on Shudder, 8 o'clock Central Time, and it'll be made available on demand a little bit after that. It's Joe Bob Briggs Halloween Hootenanny, and it's going to be special. It's a triple feature, and lots of other really cool stuff on there as well. And let me welcome back to the show the great Joe Bob Briggs. Joe Bob, how are you, sir?
I'm good, Nick. Glad to be back on the show. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
It's always great to have you on, man. How you been?
I've been good. I've been preparing the Halloween Hootenanny.
Yeah,
Better than a wing ding.
I guess I've always believed that. I've always believed a hootenanny is better than a wing ding. Yeah. So let me ask
you. They don't let me tell the titles. I would love to tell you the titles of the movies we're going to show, but part of the, I don't know, the format of the show, I guess, is we never reveal the titles in advance. People have to show up and find out what we're going to do.
Yeah. But, well, that's good. That's fine. I don't think, I mean, look, I'll watch and I don't care what you're showing. I just think you're great. I'll watch you do anything. Hey, the last time you were on with us was when you were touring around and you did the music box.
That's right. We missed you at the music box.
Yeah, I know. My producer Tom came down and saw it and said it was just fantastic. How'd that whole thing go?
Oh, that was a wild, rowdy crowd. I loved it. I just loved it. People had to fight their way to the theater because it was I don't know if you know, the theater's right there by Wrigley Field.
Yeah.
And it was a Cubs White Sox night. Sold out.
Right.
And so everyone was like fighting their way to the theater. And so they were in the mood to have a good time once they got there.
Yeah.
So, anyway, no, it was a great night. We had a lot of fun. Some people came in costume. I used to just do that show. The show is called How Rednecks Saved Hollywood.
Right.
And it's a very Southern show, and it's about redneck movies, and it's about sort of the history of the redneck told in film. And I used to never do the show in the North. I only did the show in Southern cities, you know, preferably cities that love their Confederate monuments, you know, because there's a certain kind of,
right.
There's a certain kind of humor that we have in the South that, you know, that doesn't always translate. So I was preparing the material and I was saying, you know, this show is really for places where people love their guns. And then I thought, oh, Chicago. Okay, fine.
Right.
We're like, okay, with Chicago. But anyway, they accepted me. They accepted me there. And since then I've done it in other northern cities. So.
Right. Well, I'm glad you were able to bring it to Chicago. And the music boxes the programming that they do there is just so diverse and so cool. They're always willing to take a chance. Like coming up this weekend, in fact, is the Music Box Massacre. It's a 24-hour horror movie marathon that starts Saturday at noon and ends Sunday at noon. And it's
yeah,
a, it's an endurance I've, test.
Yeah, I've hosted a few of those.
Yeah.
Iron Man marathons is what I call them.
Yeah, yeah.
You got to be ready for those.
I've lived through a few in my day. You know, sitting there and like people bringing sleeping bags and laying on the floor of the theater, which I wouldn't recommend. But you know, that kind of thing. Joe Bob, let's go back to really quickly to give everybody a little. How did this whole thing start? How did you start when you were a kid? Did you love B movies and horror movies and stuff like that?
When I was a kid, I loved all movies, but The thing with exploitation movies really started when I was older, and I didn't just review horror. I reviewed movies that at the time, I mean, we're talking about the early 80s. At the time, these were exploitation movies were a despised art form.
Right.
They weren't reviewed at all by newspapers. So I worked for a newspaper and I started doing a column called Joe Bob Goes to the Drive-In.
Right.
Because the only place you could see the movies was at the drive-in. Or in more urban places, you could see them at the grindhouses, which were always in the deteriorating downtown area.
Right.
You know, and so, so for a long time, I was the only person reviewing this type of film, and it was well received by movie lovers, but it was not well received by moral censors, and so. You know, what's weird to me is that I was constantly under attack from, the Baptists or the one organization or another. The films were considered pornography, even though they were not pornography. They were just exploitation films.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
What today would be called genre films.
Right.
And so.
And at that time, Joe, they were everywhere, like in video stores. I mean, they were, some people referred to them as video nasties.
Oh, yeah.
And even before
people had VHS, they were in, they played the drive-ins,
right,
in the frame houses,
right.
And they would play for 1 week, and then they would, you'd never see them again.
Yeah.
Or they would come around the next year with a new title.
Right.
But what's interesting to me is the censor would come along and he would say, Joe Bob, you can't really say these things because you'll offend the older people, you know?
Yeah.
And so now that I'm one of the older people, the censor comes along to say, Joe Bob, you can't say these things because you'll offend the younger people, you know, the millennials, the post-millennials.
Right.
You know? And so I'm like, well, wait a minute, when do I get to be offended?
Yeah. So you started, but you've had this unbelievable career, and so the work that you've done with Shudder has been really great, and you're getting ready to bring back The Last Drive-In, correct?
Yeah, we got renewed for, we hadn't been canceled yet, we got renewed for a second season.
Yeah.
And the Halloween Hootenanny is kind of a warm-up for the second season of The Last Drive-In, so we're going to do one more mini marathon prior to the starting the second season of The Last Drive-In. The Last Drive-In is a Friday night double feature you're supposed to say genre films now. You're not supposed to say exploitation films, but
yeah.
You know, the best and the worst horror films.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that as we talked about last time, because we started out so big with, we broke the internet. And
right, right, right.
It's become an appointment TV thing on a streaming service.
Yeah.
Which never happens. You know, I mean, streaming services, normally you just drop the show on a certain day and people watch it whenever they want to watch it.
Right.
We have this rabid audience that shows up exactly at the time that we first do the show. So, and they gather together through social media, especially through Twitter, but also through, Facebook, Instagram, all the others.
Yeah. Well, that's, we got to take a break here, Joe Bob. Hang on a second.
Okay.
Right, Joe Bob Briggs is with us, and we're going to talk more about the Halloween Hootenanny, which is going to be dropped on Shudder this Friday night at 8 p.m. Central Time. It is the Joe Bob's Halloween Hootenanny, the triple feature, and lots of other things. We're going to talk about that and more here on WGN. We'll return after this with more Joe Bob Briggs on WGN. right. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline Studio on a Thursday morning. Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs here on 720 WGN. And my guest right now is the great Joe Bob Briggs. He is the king of the drive-in. He's a TV host. You can follow him on Twitter at TheRealJoeBob. On Friday night at 8 o'clock Central Time, Shudder is going to drop the new show, Joe Bob Briggs Halloween Hootenanny. And that's what we're talking about. Let's bring Joe Bob back. Joe Bob, welcome back, sir.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank
so you. So the Hootenanny, now we can't talk about the titles that you're showing, but what were some of the other things that are going to be involved? I understand that Darcy the Male Girl is of course going to be there.
Darcy the Male Girl has an increasingly important role in the show, because I think partly because of the generational difference between us, that she's always disagreeing with me about the relative value of various films, and that cause, and people like that. They like people sort of punching holes. It's like, you know, back when I was on, I used to have a show on TNT called Monster Vision.
Right.
And I could get away with anything. I could just, like, it started really before the internet was big and there was no information on these films. And I could just get away with anything.
Yeah, yeah.
Now I make one little mistake and 9,000 people are all over me within
right.
5 minutes,
right.
you know?
Right.
And so Darcy is kind of a millennial reminder that I'm being watched. I'm being watched at all times. Her most notorious challenge of me was, she said, the remake of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre is better than the original.
Oh my God!
And I'm like, I said, are there other people who share this opinion with you? And she's like, oh yes, this is. I was just like appalled. But,
I'm sorry. I just that gave me a chill down my spine, Joe Bob, right there. You know, it's interesting because, like, every time I hear that they're going to remake, you know, some classic horror movie, I immediately just go no. But some of them turn out pretty good. I enjoyed. It's not nearly as good as the original, but I enjoyed the remake of Dawn of the Dead. Even though I prefer my zombies slow.
Right.
And I just thought last year's remake of Suspiria was really great, and it was a completely different movie than what Argento did. But I was, because Suspiria is one of my favorite movies of all time, and when I heard they were remaking it, I was like, you got to be kidding me. And then the direction that it took was completely different, and of course it was like an hour longer than
the original. Well, yeah, and they're not always remakes. They're reimaginings
right.
and reshapings and everything. And so if you do that, I mean, Tom Savini in 1990, I think, made a remake of the original Night of the Living Dead, which was very good.
It was.
Very good.
Really
and,
good, yeah.
And he came up with a way of doing a little bit different ending that makes a lot of sense.
Yep.
And I think it's a very underrated film. Nobody watches it. Everyone watches the original. They don't watch the Tom Savini remake. So,
yeah.
I mean, I think the Hills Have Eyes remake was good.
Yeah.
You know, the original Hills Have Eyes is kind of grainy and dark, and the remake had a lot more money and just, you know, delivered a lot more.
Yeah.
It can happen, but, you know, ultimately it's kind of it's a degenerate era if all we're doing is reviving old standards, you know.
Yeah.
Are we going to make every Stephen King movie every 5 years,
just
keep making it over and over and over again? You know, it's like, it becomes like Broadway, you know, Broadway musicals, you know, it's like, let's do Oklahoma again. Let's do Music Man again. You know,
I know.
sort of what horror is becoming.
It's interesting. I mean, I'm actually really interested in Dr. Sleep, which of course people know is the sequel to The Shining, which is coming out in a couple of weeks. I really hope it's good. The Mike Flanagan has turned out to be a pretty successful horror director at this point.
Yeah, I always hope that they're all good. Some of them are kind of like I'm going to sound like an old fart here, but the young generation of filmmakers shy away from horror a little bit in the following way. They always try to make it horror comedy. Even if they're making a straight horror film, they inject comedy, I think, as a self-protective way, because it's harder to go for solid scares, to sort of tap into our basic fears.
Yeah.
And you sort of don't have to do that if you're constantly relieving it with comedy. And so that trend, I don't like at all.
Right.
I would rather they go for it, you know.
Yeah, I think I think the director that's doing that right now is Ari Aster. Between Midsommar and Hereditary, my God. I mean, although Midsommar has Midsommar does have some big laughs in it, but it's really one of the most twisted films I've seen all year. And I love what that guy's doing.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I think Ty West is another one that has a lot going on.
Yeah.
Very, very intelligent films, very scary films, very unpredictable films. We live in an interesting time because it's like horror has become a genre, not a subgenre, not a specialty genre.
Right.
It's become one of the genres right up there with, you know, comedy and drama and action.
I have to ask you, you know, since the last time you were here, Tarantino's movie came out, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I would love to get your take on that. What did you think of that?
Well, I have not had a chance to see it because I've been constantly on the road. I haven't. And doing my show, so I haven't seen it yet.
I think you'll love it. I absolutely loved it. I don't know if you've heard, but Brad Pitt's character lives in a trailer right next to a drive-in.
I did hear that.
And so there's some great stuff that takes place there, and he really captures, and Tarantino really recreates that time period perfectly. And it's got a great amount. The last like 20 minutes of the movie is just mayhem. Utter mayhem. And I can't wait till you see it because I think it's great.
Okay. Well, I'm sure I will because I like almost everything he does.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. This is a good one. I think this is one of his very best. So, one of the topics that we're going to do after we let you go, Joe Bob, in honor, obviously, of Halloween is the least scary movies of all time. You know, we always talk about like the scariest movies of all time, the classics. You know, you got your Halloween, you got your Exorcist, you got your Texas Chainsaw, the original. But what about the least scary? I've got a list here that I'm going to go through, and we're going to talk about movies that were supposed to be scary, didn't be scary. What are some of the ones? And I mean, have you shown some of the least scary movies of all time?
Yeah, I have. I mean, I would say Blood Harvest, starring Tiny Tim, was one of the least scary horror movies ever made. There was a movie called Super Beast that was filmed in the Philippines that was just people wandering around in the Philippine jungle for 2 hours. there's no beast, much less a super beast.
Uh-huh.
there's almost too many too many to count.
Yeah.
It's hard to scare people. It is hard to scare people, and it's hard to get down to fundamental fears. And so, there are movies that where the acting is just so bad that it can't possibly be scary.
Yeah.
And sometimes even in some of the larger budget things, and I'm gonna get the number wrong, but I think I'm thinking of Friday the 13th Five.
Okay.
Friday the 13th Part Five. I think, you know, somehow they just got the wrong cast and the wrong director, and it just didn't work.
Yeah.
But I may be wrong because I get the numbers.
I get those.
But
they all kind of meld together at some point. They really do. Listen, Joe Bob, always great talking to you. But I want to give it one more plug for what's happening on the Joe Bob Briggs Halloween Hootenanny. It's a triple feature, and you won't find out what the movies are until. It begins on Friday night at 8 o'clock Central Time on Shudder, and getting ready for season two of The Last Drive-In. Have you picked out some of the movies for the next season?
Oh yeah, we pretty much know what we're going to do. Yeah.
Oh
yeah.
Great.
We can't tell you those either though.
That's okay. That's all right. People will tune in anyway. Joe Bob, always right. Man, it's always so great to have you on the show. You're one of my favorite guests of all time, man.
Thanks, Nick.
All right,
I appreciate it.
Take care.
Okay.
All right. Joe Bob Briggs, everybody, the king of the drive-in. God, he's the best. I miss drive-ins too. That's another thing I miss. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about drive-ins later on. But Joe Bob Briggs, Halloween Hootenanny is Friday night, October 25th, this Friday, on Shudder, and it'll be dropped at 8 p.m. Central Time. It's a triple feature. All kinds of other great things will be happening. And in between, you'll get by-play between Joe Bob and Darcy the Mail Girl, as well as other surprises. So Joe Bob Briggs, Halloween Hootenanny, Friday night on Shudder, 8 p.m. Central Time. Make sure you're tuned into that. My thanks to the great Joe Bob Briggs. All right, we shall return on 720 WGN with the news. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It's Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday! And that means one artist, three songs, or in this case, one musical, three songs. Ben, who requested that?
Ike from Country Club Hills.
Ike. All right, requesting a little Shop of Horrors. So there you go. It's actually one of my favorite musicals. All right, welcome back, everybody. It is Halloween time. And we usually talk about like the really scary movies, but we're going to talk about the least scary movies of all time and just bad ones. Complex Magazine put together a really entertaining and funny look at 50 of the least scary movies of all time, some really bad horror movies. 312-981-7200. I think it seems appropriate that our guest this morning was Joe Bob Briggs, who has shown some of the worst movies of all time, and he would be the first to admit that some of the movies that he's shown over the years and years and years that he's been a TV host and horror host have been pretty awful. And same thing with Sven. I know that Rich would admit that some of the movies that he's shown over the years have just been awful and ridiculous. And that's the case here. And we're leading with the least scary movies of all time. So the phone lines are open. The text lines are open at 312-981-7200. So a little bit earlier, I was talking about that they actually announced Mattel Films, which I didn't even know was a thing, announced that they are making a Barney the Purple Dinosaur movie. So we got a couple of texts regarding that. 301 area code says, what, no Stretch Armstrong movie? I don't know if that was a Mattel product. But, you know, hell, if they're going to make movies out of any, you know, like Magic 8 Ball, I mean... Doc, our good friend Doc, says, Nick, the only way I could see the Barney movie is if it's a double feature. And by that, I mean a little session with Puff the Magic Dragon before watching Barney. I see. I see what you're doing there, Doc. 301 area code says, least scary movies ever, every movie ever made by Ed Wood and Larry Buchanan and The Asylum. And then 847 area code says, rubber, you just can't get scared by a tire. That's an actual thing. That's a real thing. That's a movie about a killer tire just rolling in. And it's real. And I've seen it. And it's terrible and not scary. But let's take a look at some of the titles that Complex Magazine thinks are among the least scary movies of all time. Bad horror movies, the least scary. So coming in the list right here is Halloween from 2007, directed by Rob Zombie. And I couldn't agree more. This movie's a disgrace, an absolute disgrace, taking what I think is the greatest horror movie ever made and just, like, not knowing anything about... Well, first of all, all of Rob Zombie's movies suck. They're all terrible. They're all absolutely terrible. He is a horrible filmmaker, and his movies suck. And here's what they say about Halloween from 2007. Jamie Lee Curtis is rolling in her grave and she's not even dead yet. This ugly remake full of horror convention and sax and horror convention, sad sax and hillbilly drama should have ended with Myers' escape from the mental hospital, but Zombie insists on cramming the entirety of Carpenter's 78 masterpiece into the final act, forcing you to sit through a far inferior version of the events that you know all too well. The only thing worse than Rob Zombie's Halloween is Rob Zombie's Halloween 2. Totally agree. Here's a sad entry. Phantom of the Opera from Dario Argento. It stars Julia Sands and Asha Argento. And, you know, Dario has not made a good movie in a long time. He's made some of the best giallo movies of all time, and in my opinion, the scariest movie ever made, which is Suspiria. But he lost a lot of steps over the years, and this one is definitely not good. Gone are the fantastic visual styles of the giallo that catapulted director Dario Argento to worldwide fame. The English dubbing is scarier than anything else you'll find on the screen, except maybe for Julian Sands' beautiful coiffure. The Phantom is as pretty as Christine, but he occasionally romps naked with rats. Weird, yes. Sexy, not really. Sorry, Dario. Yeah, that's not good. It's not good. His version, he also did a film, I guess it was about 7-8 years ago, Dracula 3D. And it was awful. It had Rutger Hauer in it, unfortunately. The late, great Rutger Hauer. That was awful. Now, here's a movie that they include that I know a lot of people like. I don't. I think it sucks. But I know a lot of people like Children of the Corn. With Peter Horton, Linda Hamilton, R.G. Armstrong, Courtney Gaines. I know that movie has a lot of fans. Over the years, you know, whenever we've talked about horror movies, people do like it, and people include it among some of the better Stephen King adaptations, but I think the movie's terrible. It's a terrible movie. It came out in 1984. You know, I remember reading the story, you know, and thinking the story was pretty cool, but then the movie just really, they really, really screwed it up. And then they did, and then they, I think, if I'm not mistaken, there are more than a few or a few Children of the Corn direct-to-video sequels that they just kept making. And then there was a remake of Children of the Corn not too long ago. But this is the one they're talking about, is the one from 1984, the first one that came out. And it made money at the box office. It was a low-budget movie from New World Pictures. It made money at the box office, but, you know, it's not good. It's in fact, it's really bad, and it's not scary. And here's what they say about it. Nothing takes us out of a scene quicker than bad child acting, so you can imagine how difficult it is to get into a movie with a cast full of underwhelming kids. Add to that a lot of religious sermonizing, and it's impossible to keep your eyes from rolling. We wish we could send this one back up the cornhole from which it came. Yeah. I just thought it was terrible. But I know it's got a cult following. It does. It's got a cult following. And, you know, all the years that I've been talking about horror movies, and all the years that I've been a part of Flashback Convention, and that goes back 17 years, you know, we've had guests show up from Children of the Corn. Including Courtney Gaines, who actually couldn't be a cooler guy. Everybody remembers Courtney Gaines. I think he plays Malachi in it. I don't remember. But he's a red-haired guy. He's been in a lot of movies, goofy looking. He's the guy at the end of Back to the Future who cuts in and during the dance at the end when Crispin Glover is supposed to kiss Leia Thompson. And he's the guy who cuts in and grabs her. And he's like, he's laughing. He's got the red hair.
Oh yeah,
When Michael J. Fox is slowly disappearing on stage as he's playing guitar because he's being erased from history. That's Courtney Gaines. He's been in a ton of stuff.
Was it weird talking about one of his movies the other day? I was in with you, The Burbs.
Yes, he's in The Burbs. He's great in The Burbs. Yeah, but he couldn't be a nicer guy. He is really, and he's not weird at all. And he's a very, very cool guy. But there were a lot of people there at he's been at the Flashback Convention a couple of times with other Children of the Corn cast members, and they get big, long lines at their tables for photographs and for autographs. So it does have a following. I just don't get it. I've never liked it. I hated it the first time I saw it. And then as the years have gone by and it suddenly has this kind of a cult reputation and some really intense fans, I tried to give it a second and third chance to watch it again. Didn't work for me. So, now here's one it's completely inexplicable, especially the time that it came out. This is House at the End of the Street, which came out in 2012, which was like right when Jennifer Lawrence's career like really started to take off big time. Jennifer Lawrence, Elizabeth Shue, Max Terriot, Gil Bellows. And I don't know. I think she probably got talked into making this movie. I think she probably got talked into making the movie before her career took off. That would be my guess, is that it kind of sat on the shelf for about a year. But it says, if a stranger were to meet Jennifer Lawrence, find out she's an actress, and ask what movies she's been in recently, there's no chance in hell she'd ever say, in addition to successes like The Hunger Games and Silver Linings Playbook, I was also in this horror film called House at the End of the Street. She and her handlers would be wise to ignore this turkey's existence. There's a decent little teeny bopper thriller hidden somewhere inside this sloppily constructed quasi-riff on Psycho. It's just too bad that the film about a girl who moves next door to a social outcast who may or may not be harboring some deep, dark family secrets parlays its so-so first half into an idiotic, overly ambitious second half that's triggered by a ridiculous twist and some unconvincing, manic acting from co-star Mac Terrio. Yeah, it's a terrible movie. And again, it came out in 2012, and this was a time when Jennifer Lawrence had become Jennifer Lawrence. This is not like before Winter's Bone. Winter's Bone was her big breakout, and then obviously all these other critically acclaimed movies and an Academy Award, and you know, now she's Jennifer Lawrence, you know, like mega superstar and considered a really terrific actor, perennial nominee, been in some very successful tentpole movies as well. But this thing was terrible. And I remember being kind of excited about it because I love Jennifer Lawrence. I think she's great. And, you know, they cut together a pretty good trailer because they really wanted to suck people like me in, people who really like Jennifer Lawrence and like horror. So I was very excited about it. I was like, oh, it's my favorite genre and I love Jennifer Lawrence. This is going to be great. Wow, was it bad. So I don't really know the history behind it, but my guess is she shot this thing maybe like right after Winter's Bone or something, and it sat on a shelf somewhere. And then finally a producer said, hey, you know, we should release this piece of garbage in the theaters right now and try to make as much quick money on it because of her popularity right now. So anyway, it's terrible. House at the End of the Street, not scary. Another stupid one. So if you guys want to jump in here, we're talking about the least scariest movies of all time. So the bad ones. What were the disappointing ones? Which ones are like, what? 312-981-7200. Here's John on WGN. Hi, John.
Hello. Yes, I went to college with John Franklin, who was the actor who played Malachi in Children of the Corn. He was 24 at the time. He was a little person who specialized in playing young teenage or children. He also was Cousin It in the Addams Family movies. He did both the bodywork and the voice, because he could do that weird little Cousin It voice.
Yeah. All right. Well, yeah,
he did a ton of commercials. He did a ton of TV commercials. So he was always playing like a 12-year-old, but he was in his 20s.
Okay.
And now he's 60.
Yeah. No, I appreciate it. I know who you're talking about. I just got to get the names mixed up because I don't know what I can't remember the name of the character that Courtney Gaines played. I have no idea what it was. So, all right. Thanks, John.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, John Franklin was the actor's name who played Malachi. They all had biblical names. All of the Children of the Corn had biblical names, but I don't remember what Courtney Gaines' name was. So, all right, let's take a break, shall we? Let's do that. And what do you guys think? What are some of the worst or just least scary horror movies that you've ever seen? And we got a bunch more here to talk about, and we would love to hear from you at 312-981-7200 for talk and text. More after this.
You'll be a dentist. You have a talent for causing pain. Some be a dentist. People will pay you to be a new game. Your temperament's wrong for the priesthood, and teaching would suit you still less. So be a dentist. You'll be a success.
Right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here on a Thursday morning. That means Triple Play Thursday. You mean Triple Play Thursday? It's one artist, three songs, and in this case, one musical, three songs. That's the second of a triple play from Little Shop of Horrors right there. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here, and our phone lines are open and our text lines are open. We want to hear from you. We're talking about the least scary movies ever made. And by the way, we got this all cleared up, this Children of the Corn nonsense. Courtney Gaines did play Malachi. John Franklin played Isaac. So I was right. Courtney Gaines did play Malachi. John Franklin, the actor that our listener went to school with, he played Isaac. And we got that all cleared up. You know, I wouldn't have been able to sleep this morning had I not figured that out. Had we not figured out one of the details of a really terrible movie. Children of the Corn. That was, you know, that was, I remember, man, that movie did make money, though. Like, and it was, like, zero budgeted, but Linda Hamilton is in it. Speaking of Linda Hamilton, this new Terminator movie is getting great reviews.
That's what I've heard.
Now, I'm still like, ugh, I don't know. Because I think that franchise went south a long time ago.
I agree with you, and you and I have talked before about that. But I am really interested to see Linda Hamilton back in the mix.
Yeah, I'm that's cool, you know. But man, I like the last one that I liked was the third one with the okay. with the female Terminator and the chase scene with the crane smashing through buildings and stuff.
Yeah,
which was not CGI. They were smashing a crane through buildings like that was real.
It was really cool.
Great. So I like that one. Didn't like, what was the one after that? Was it, because there was Salvation, which was bad. That was the one with Christian Bale.
Yeah.
That was terrible.
Yeah.
And then, last one was Genesis, right?
Yep.
Terrible.
Yeah, I wasn't a fan of the last one.
And the trailers for the new one just don't do it for me. I love Linda Hamilton. I think it's cool that she came back, but I just don't, I'm watching it and I'm like, eh.
It's getting
good reviews.
Yeah. And you know me, there's a plane involved, so I'm going to go see it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. But anyway, it's getting pretty good reviews, but we'll see. It opens up next week. It opens November 1st.
Yep.
So, anyway. And I'll tell you, they're doing a lot of press for it. Linda Hamilton and Arnold Schwarzenegger are everywhere.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, and I think a lot of people are happy to see them reunited.
Did you see them on the Graham Norton show?
Not yet.
It was a great.
Yeah, no,
great
I've interview. Got it. I've got it. I've got it at home.
Yeah.
Not watched it yet. Well, Graham Norton's the best. I love Graham Norton.
I love his interviews.
He's just the best. His show is on Friday nights on BBC America. Friday nights at 10 on BBC America. I DVR it every week. He's just the best. All right. So we got that all cleared up for all you people who were really concerned about us not getting all the details of Children of the Corn right. All right, so 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Which ones would you consider the least scary movies of all time? Ones that really disappointed you? Maybe you were really looking forward to something and it just didn't do it for you. Phone lines are open at 312-981-7200. Here's Ike on WGN. Go ahead, Ike.
Hey, Nick, how's it going with you,
good.
Man? Yeah, this is kind of like the opposite of what you're talking about, because I remember when I was a kid, this movie didn't used to scare me, but now, growing up, it kind of creeps me out a little bit. The Gate.
Oh, The Gate. Yeah. I like that movie.
Yeah, I had no idea it was considered as a kid's movie, but I still watch it. It still creeps me out. It's still a good movie. Of course, you had a young Stephen Dorff.
Yeah.
You know, that was kind of weird to see.
Yeah, Stephen Dorff is like 10 in that movie. Yeah, The Gate. Yeah. All right, Ike, thanks.
No problem.
Okay. All right. Next one they talk about here is Resident Evil, and I couldn't agree more. Those movies suck. They suck. And I've talked about this before, but like any movie that's based on a video game, for the most part, sucks. The first Mortal Kombat is ridiculous and kind of fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, get down here. That whole thing. That's ridiculous and kind of fun. But all of them suck, and all the Resident Evil movies are terrible. They're terrible.
I don't mind seeing Mia Jovovich in a latex body.
Well, yeah, no, yeah. Obviously, you know, and it's directed by her. I don't know if they're still married, but her husband directed most of those movies. Paul W.S. Anderson, not to be confused with the good Paul Anderson, Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah.
But Mia Jovovich, Michelle Rodriguez is another one I love.
Yeah,
I love her too, but. The movies are terrible. They're absolutely terrible, and they're not scary at all. Hollywood takes one of the most popular video game franchises of all time, cuts out the atmosphere, suspense, and anything else that made it cool. So there you go. And adds a bunch of flat action to it. The only one I liked, the only movie that's based on a video game that I liked, was Silent Hill. That was the only one that I ever liked. And I never, and again, I'm not a gamer, so I don't play any of these games. I've never played Resident Evil ever in my life. I don't, you know. So these movies that are based on video games, I'm just seeing as movies.
Yeah.
I can't compare them to the experience of playing the video game because I don't play the video games. So Silent Hill, which was a game that I wasn't familiar with, comes out, and it makes no sense. The movie makes no sense whatsoever, like at all. But I thought it was really creepy, and I thought the visuals were good. So on the simplest of levels of like creating an atmosphere, and I think Silent Hill's a creepy movie.
Yeah, and the game was creepy. I played a little bit of it.
Yeah, people tell me the game is scary and it's creepy. And so I don't know, you know, but the plot made no sense. I didn't even know what the hell was going on when I was watching the movie, and I was like, what's happening right now? I had no idea. But I had a great time watching it. It was a fun ride. And so, you know, when I've mentioned the movie before to people who've played the game, they're like, eh. You know, the movie was like, eh. But I thought the movie was creepy. And I thought the movie was pretty effective in that regard. But again, made not a lick of sense.
Yeah.
'Cause I remember I saw it at the Bruin View. With my girlfriend at the time, who would become my wife, and a buddy of mine who is a big horror film fan. And it was the second feature. I can't remember what the first one was, but it was two horror movies. So it was something in Silent Hill. Silent Hill was first. And they both disliked it. They both thought I was nuts. So when it was over, I was like, hey, that was pretty cool. They were like, what? And I'm like, that was pretty cool. It was creepy. There was some really cool stuff in it. And they're like, get out of here. And they're both like, my ex-wife is a huge horror fan. And so it's this buddy of mine who I went with. I went to a lot of movies at that time in the mid-2000s, mid kind of late 2000s. Lots of movies with those two people.
Okay.
Lots of horror movies, I should say. I should specifically say horror movies. But yeah, they thought I was insane. But I like it. That's the only video game I've ever enjoyed was Silent Hill. So, all right. Horror movies that aren't scary. What are the least scary movies of all time? Bad ones, real bad ones, and ones that disappointed you. We're doing a turning of the tables of what we talk about usually during this time period. So 312-981-7200 for talk and text. The news is coming up right after this. Right. That's actually one of my favorite musical numbers of all time in anything. I love that song. That's Suddenly Seymour, and from the movie Little Shop of Horrors on Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, Major Play Thursday. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Talk and text lines are open. We are talking about the least scary movies you've ever seen. Stuff that disappointed you or just bad. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. So from Complex Magazine, they put together a list of 50, and we're going through them, and we want to hear from you. Which ones disappointed you? Which ones were not scary? 312-981-7200. Next one they mention is Hostel, which is a movie that I actually like. I actually like Hostel. Hated the sequel. Thought the sequel was awful, but I liked the first one. Didn't necessarily find it scary, but, of course, directed by Eli Roth. Not only did we not care if the annoying, underdeveloped protagonists live, we actually hoped they die. Yeah, that's the point. That's kind of the point of the movie. I felt the same way. It was like watching a bunch of D-bag American tourists getting tortured in Europe, and for some reason that appealed to me. No matter how many successful shoulders he stands on, director Eli Roth seems more concerned with sculpting his chest hair than directing a good film. Hostel opened the doors to a subgenre of torture porn clones that now fill clearance shelves across the country. Yeah, that's a subgenre I've never been a real big fan of. But I think that and Saw even more so, started that whole subgenre. A subgenre that I was never a big fan of. But I thought Hostel was... I also thought Hostel was really funny. You know? Yeah. So I'm a fan. They don't... They think it's bad. April Fool's Day, the remake from 2008, because the first one's good. The first April Fool's Day, the original one is good. I even forgot that they remade April Fool's Day. I completely forgot that there was a remake of April Fool's Day. It says the original April Fool's Day, released in 1986, is one of the better slasher films of its time. Underrated today and featuring one of the horror genre's strongest third act movie twists. 22 years later, nobody wanted a remake, yet that didn't stop co-directors Mitchell Altieri and Phil Flores from removing the original single location setting, clever plot turns, and general entertainment value, and crapping out a lifeless fail that would have been subpar even in the post-scream slasher resurgence of the late 90s. I mean, that barely moved. I don't even know if I saw it. I don't even remember if I saw it. I don't even remember at all that April Fool's Day was remade. Sorority House Massacre from 1986. I have a soft spot in my heart for this one. For some reason, I do. I have a soft spot in my heart for Sorority House Massacre. I mean, now granted, obviously, you can tell from the title that it's not going to be the strongest thing ever. But for some reason, like that, this is like one of those mid-80s VHS exploitation movies that was just like, you know, it was they were all over. I was talking about this with Joe Bob Briggs a little bit earlier, where every video store across the nation had shelves and shelves of these really goofy slasher movies with these really gory and provocative covers on the boxes for the movie, and that would attract young kids and go, oh, look at that. There's a lot of blood. It's very colorful. It draws you in. So they would rent these movies, and they were all low-budget crap, and Sorority House Massacre actually falls under that category, but for some reason I got kind of a soft spot for it. And they say, have you ever seen Halloween? So have these guys. Nice production values, but released in 1986, Sorority House Massacre was too late to the party of slasher knockoffs, and John Carpenter should sue.
Okay.
We got some texts coming in. 312-981-7200 if you want to check this out. 708 area code says, The Happening with Mark Wahlberg. I never left the theater, left this time. Yeah, well, that's a notoriously bad movie. I mean, really, a really, really bad movie. And even on the scale of M. Night Shyamalan, it's a bad movie. And that guy, you know, he has the bar is real, as low as it can get when it comes to M. Night Shyamalan, and that's even bad for him. Wahlberg hated it, has talked about how he hated it, and yeah. So 847 area code Reefer Madness. Well, you know, Reefer Madness is I guess it's not scary. It was meant to be. Like back when it came out, at that time, people actually thought that that's how you behaved if you smoked pot. Like even if you had one toke, you suddenly went completely nuts. And it was like a PSA, over-the-top warning against the use of marijuana. And it has since been turned into, you know, a musical. It's been turned into a parody. It's a fun movie to watch, I think. 419 area code says, the giant spider invasion. I love giant spider movies. I love them.
Even Eight-Legged Freaks?
Oh, I love Eight-Legged Freaks.
Okay, I mean, I loved it, too. I wouldn't consider it scary, but I love
it. No, it's funny as hell.
Yeah.
But I love Eight-Legged Freaks. And the classic from the 50s, Tarantula, with the giant tarantula, that's a classic. I used to watch that on Saturday afternoons when they would show it on Channel 32, and I love that. I love that movie.
What was the one with Shatner?
Shatner was in Kingdom of the Spiders, but they weren't giant spiders.
No.
They were regular tarantulas.
Okay.
847 area codes. Carrie? You don't think Carrie is scary? This person doesn't think Carrie is scary?
I mean, just the grave scene alone. And we talked about that the other
day. You're talking about the remake with with Chloe Grace Moretz, which is one of the most unnecessary remakes of all time. Maybe if you're talking about that. But the original Carrie that Brian De Palma directed with Sissy Spacek and Piper Laurie is scary.
Yeah.
It's a really scary movie. 847 area code says, The Darkling, a movie I wish I had never spent time watching. The Darkling? I don't know if I know The Darkling. Okay. 779 area code says, I watched Troll 3 as a dare. Okay. Troll 3. And then Gingerbread Man was just bad. Yeah, Gingerbread Man is a ridiculous movie. 847 area code says, not sure if you count this, but what about the horrible decisions that went into the made-for-TV version of It? Did someone really say, okay, we're filming one of the scariest books ever, we need Harry Anderson, John Ritter, Tim Reed, Annette O'Toole, Richard Mazur, and Tim Curry. Tim Curry's great in the TV version of It. He's a great Pennywise. Now, the TV version of It, not very good. It's not nearly as good as the movie version, obviously. But Tim Curry's great. 815 Erica says, the 2009 remake of Friday the 13th was straight trash. Yes, it was. Yes, it was. All right, the next one that they mention here in the article is the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Beginning, from 2006, which is just a horrible movie. Jordana Brewster, Arlie Ermey's in it. How scary can a movie be when it's merely a prologue and you know what it will, and you know who will and won't survive? Furthermore, an icon should not be born from casual opportunity, as is the case when Leatherface just happens to grab a chainsaw after bashing in his first skull. Good thing he wasn't braining someone in a porn shop, or the iconic implement could be something else. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Beginning, I mean, that's just, it's unspeakably bad. Like, truly. Truly awful. All right, how about this one? Exorcist, The Beginning, from 2004, directed by Rennie Harlan. Stellan Skarsgård was the star of that. This was a movie that was there ended up being two versions of the movie because they're doing an Exorcist movie, and Paul Schrader's version the producers didn't like, so they brought in Rennie Harlan to do a bunch of reshoots and change the movie. So you ended up with two movies. You ended up with Exorcist Dominion, which was the Paul Schrader version, written and directed by Paul Schrader, and then Exorcist The Beginning, which is Rennie Harlan. Now, the project was doomed from the beginning, especially when they split it into two movies. I didn't hate Exorcist The Beginning as much as everybody else did, because for some reason, I have an affinity for Rennie Harlan movies. I love his movies. Father Marin's origin story was already covered in Exorcist II, The Heretic, and it wasn't chilling then either. Officially, this fourth film was a thoughtful study of faith by Paul Schrader, the kind that it is so scary because it feels real, but the studio wanted more action, so the director of Cutthroat Island was brought in. Confounding reshoots and crazy CGI jackals turned this movie into what should have been exercised from the get-go. Yeah. Let's see. 219 area code, Teeth, the worst scary movie ever and the worst movie ever. Totally disagree. I think Teeth is great. You ever seen Teeth?
Can't say that I have.
You know what the plot of Teeth is?
No. I have a guess.
It involves a woman who has a private part that has teeth. So there you go.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and it's great. It's great. Attack of the Killer Shrews is bad, from the 779 area code. Let's see, 815 area code says, Nick, I want to nominate Leprechaun as one of the least scariest movies ever. We could have stopped his shenanigans by suggesting going for a pint of Guinness, and that would have solved this little horror movie in a heartbeat. So there you go. Yeah, Leprechaun is legendary, but they've made so many of them, that became a popular title.
So, after hearing the one about the shrews,
yeah,
I'm going to nominate one.
Okay.
Zombievers.
Oh, Zombievers, yes.
Yeah.
I made it through about 20 minutes of that. Yeah, I made it through about 20 minutes of that. But yeah. So, but yeah, you know, this the attack of the Shrews was bad. And Leprechaun, but Leprechaun is, you can't, you know, you can't, I don't know if, because Leprechaun is on a different level, because it's just so, I mean, the people who make those movies know their crap.
Yeah.
I mean, they made Leprechaun in space, they made Leprechaun in the Hood with Snoop Dogg.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And everybody, of course, now some of the legendary stories behind Leprechaun, obviously people know that that's like one of the first movies that Jennifer Aniston was ever in.
Mm-hmm.
And her, if you watch scenes from that movie, her nose looks a little bit different than it did on Friends. So let's take a quick call here. We're talking about the least scary movies of all time. Phone lines, text lines are open. Let's hear from you at 312-981-7200. Here's Bruce on WGN. Hi, Bruce.
Hey, Nick. How you doing, buddy?
All right.
Hey, there was a movie back in the late 90s with Johnny Depp called The Ninth Gate.
Yeah.
Do you remember that one?
I do.
It was the only movie I've ever walked out on.
Yeah, it's
terrible.
It's not good, and if I remember correctly, directed by Roman Polanski.
All right.
So it was not a good movie. Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Bruce.
Yeah, buddy.
Yeah, The Ninth Gate. Oh man. Yeah, that was a rough one. All right, let's take a break here, and we got plenty more unscary movies to talk about. Which ones are the least scary? Which ones are disappointing to you? Which ones are maybe other people think are scary, but you don't? Like Carrie, like this person who thought Carrie wasn't scary. Because it is. It's really scary. But maybe this guy... I know people who don't think The Exorcist are scary. My mom and dad, when they first saw it, went with another couple when it first came out. They waited in line for an hour and a half, got to the window, it was sold out. They had to go back the next night, wait again an hour and a half in line, and then they finally got in and they saw it. And by the way, that was in January of 1974. January in Chicago, waiting in line on the northwest side outside of the Gateway Theater, two nights in a row to see The Exorcist. That's the kind of phenomenon and insanity that movie was causing when it came out. So my parents go and see it. My dad's not really affected by horror movies. He took me to see a million of them. He would never really freaked out. Exorcist was like, yeah, it's kind of scary, but nah. My dad is not affected by that stuff. Scared the hell out of my mom. She couldn't sleep for 3 days after seeing it. But they went with another couple. And the man who the husband of the husband from the other couple laughed his ass off during the whole movie. Like, he laughed out loud during The Exorcist. I don't know how it's possible. I don't know how it's possible. Didn't scare him. In fact, he thought it was funny. So, He's like Beetlejuice, because Beetlejuice saw The Exorcist about 179 times. So, all right, let's take a break here, and we're talking about the least scary movies and disappointing ones here in this Halloween season. 312-981-7200. Oh boy. Of all days, someone requests Barry Manilow on Triple Play Thursday. So we've got two more Barry Manilow songs to endure.
Oh, yeah.
Who in God's name requested Barry Manilow?
They were smart. Did not give a name.
Oh.
Just 630 area code.
630 area code requesting Barry Manilow on Triple Play Thursday. Ugh. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text if you want to get in here on your Triple Play Thursday requests. Coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell, and the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.
Boom.
Here on WGN. All right. We're talking about the least scary movies of all time. How about I Know What You Did Last Summer, which is a terrible movie. Jennifer Love Hewitt, I forgot Ryan Phillippe is in that. Sarah Michelle Gellar, Freddie Prinze Jr., Anne Heche. Jeez. I mean, I remember Jennifer Love Hewitt being in it. That's about all. That's the only thing I remember. And the guy is basically dressed like the Gorton's fisherman, the killer.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I remember. I remember the movie being terrible, and it came out at that. It came out that post Scream time, where they were making, they were trying to repeat the formula of Scream over and over and over again, and making the posters look like Scream. Like the poster design, the art design on the posters was exactly the same. They were just trying to grab that Scream crowd. And you got Neve Campbell in Scream, so they put them another Party of Five star in I Know What You Did Last Summer with Jennifer Love Hewitt. And it says here, when your villain is dressed like the Gorton's fisherman, who gives a crap what you did last summer? That's about as scary as Jennifer Love Hewitt's acting reel. So, all right. Then we've got the Nightmare on Elm Street remake, which was shot right here in Chicago. Came out in 2010. Absolutely terrible. Rooney Mara, Jackie Earle Haley, who played Freddy Krueger. Just a bad idea in general. You know, as we've talked about, even on the show this morning, that sometimes just don't remake a movie. Like, you don't remake Nightmare on Elm Street. You don't recast. Nobody on the planet should play Freddy Krueger, but Robert Englund. And I think Jackie Earle Haley is a great actor. I think he's terrific. And I think he tried to put his own spin on Freddy Krueger, but that is such an iconic role that is so completely associated with one actor and one actor only. Just anybody, just ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. A bad idea from the get-go, and the movie, the execution was terrible. And unfortunately was shot here. Remaking A Nightmare on Elm Street should have given first-time filmmaker and music video veteran Samuel Bayer's imagination free rein to conceive all kinds of visual madness. After all, Freddy Krueger, here played by Jackie Earle Haley, who should have known better, they say, does his killing in people's dreams where anything is possible, instead, say, of staging scenes in which Krueger slaughters teenagers using Twizzlers while riding a unicorn. Bayer lazily remade several of the original film's famous scenes. Couple that with infuriating familiarity with Bayer's basic inability to establish tension, you've got one of the worst horror remakes of all time. Yes. Absolutely. Completely agree. And once again, nobody but Robert Englund is Freddy Krueger. Nobody. You can't. So, I don't know if they're a lot of big actors and actresses have parts that are completely associated with them, and that are their roles that no one else on the planet can play. You know, like, why don't you remake the Godfather and see if you can get somebody to play Michael Corleone, who isn't Al Pacino, or get somebody to play Vito, who's not Marlon Brando. It's on that level. And, you know, Freddy Krueger is one of the most iconic characters in horror film history. And Robert Englund's performance as Freddy is one of the best. So, terrible idea. All right, let's take a break. The news is coming up after this. Well, then you're feeling sad right now, because I feel sad that I have to listen to this. Jeez. Morning, Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. We're right here on 720 WGN. One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. It's Halloween time, and we always love to talk about horror movies. Most of the time, we talk about the really good, scary stuff, and we recommend stuff for people to see. But this morning, we're talking about the disappointing stuff. The least scary movies of all time, the bad ones. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We've been talking about that. We are also going to talk about some of the best examples of sketch comedy of the past 20 years. Not just from SNL, but from all of the shows that feature sketch comedy. The Washington Post wrote a really good piece about some of the most important pieces of sketch comedy of all time. And we'll get into that. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Back to the worst of all time. And the least scary. Alone in the Dark with Christian Slater, Tara Reid, and Stephen Dorff. The fantastic Uwe Boll directed that, one of the many movies that he's made based on video games. It's terrible. Next one they mention is Mirrors, directed by Alexander Aja, which is a movie I actually like. He's the director of High Tension. He did the Hills Have Eyes remake. He did Piranha 3D. He just did the Alligator movie, Crawl, which was great. I think he's terrific. There are scenes in Mirrors that I actually think are really pretty scary and kind of gross. So I did not hate that one. Now here's some texts. Nick, Jim says, Thrillorama, caught it on late night cable. It was borderline porn with a couple of sight gags, including killer sperm. Okay. 765 area code says, anything directed by Rob Zombie, especially his horrible, unnecessary, and completely sacrilegious remake of Halloween. This person must have just tuned in because we covered Rob Zombie and his nonsense movies, especially Halloween. 708 area code says, The Village. Another M. Night Shyamalan fiasco with one of the stupidest twist endings ever in the history of stupid twist endings. 312 area code says, I don't think Heathers was supposed to be scary, but Christian Slater made it scary. Yeah, I love that movie. I think Heathers is great. 815 area code says, Sleepaway Camp is so bad it makes Friday the 13th look like Halloween. Yeah, Sleepaway Camp, until that final shot, until the ending. Like, it's your basic, crappy 80s slasher movie that were coming out every week. They were made for no budgets. They didn't have to star anybody with it. You know, they didn't have to put anybody with a name in it. Just put some girls who have boobs in it. Put some obnoxious guys in it. Put a killer in some sort of outfit, a mask or something. And then just kill off the teenagers for an hour and a half. Release it after you shoot it 3 weeks ago. It'll get into theaters, and in the early 80s, it will make money. And then when it comes out on video, you'll make even more money. And Sleepaway Camp totally fits into that category. Totally fits into subpar slasher 80s nonsense until that final moment. Until the final scene of the movie. Which is still just like one of the most legendary, insane endings of any movie that I've ever seen. 815 area code says, the least scary movie I've seen in years is Hereditary. Okay, you're wrong. My wife and I sat there laughing out loud through the entire movie at how unintentionally hilarious it was and how bad it was. If you were laughing out loud the entire movie, you were disturbing the people who were actually watching the movie. So you should have left. If you thought it was that bad and hilarious, instead of laughing out loud, you should have left. Hereditary is one of the scariest movies I've seen in 20 years. It's a great movie. This text is completely wrong. And laughing out loud during it, you were disturbing the other people in the theater who were probably really enjoying it and thinking it was very scary, except for the scary couple who were laughing obnoxiously in the theater. That's actually the truth. TF Create says, Doom. It could have been a good movie, but it didn't decide what it wanted to be. Doom, that was with The Rock, right? Another one based on a video game?
Yeah, and Carl Urban, I believe.
God, I don't even remember. I remember it being bad. And that's another one. It's another one based on a video game, so I have no way to measure.
Yeah, I was disappointed with that one.
I just know Doom is mostly... Isn't Doom mostly just a first-person shooter?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
So I don't know. All right. I don't know.
It could have been so much better than what they did.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I remember seeing the movie and thinking it sucked, but I don't... Yeah. The game is not something I play, so I don't know. Yeah. Todd says the only good thing about that Barry Manilow song was that Nicolas Cage movie. Oh, yeah. Mandy, which was the last Nicolas Cage movie, which was completely insane. How about 301 area code says The Creeping Terror and The Crawling Hand. Yeah, those aren't great, but and they're not very scary, but some of those are classically ridiculous, you know, bad movies. I could watch those movies. I enjoy watching those movies, especially in the context of somebody like Joe Bob Briggs or our good friend Svengoolie. 816 area code says, I remember watching scary movies with Abbott and Costello and the Bowery Boys, and they were anything but scary. They were stupid mostly. Yeah, but they're fun. Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein is a terrific movie. You know? You got all the classic monsters in it. It's got classic bits. maybe it's not necessarily very scary. When I was a little kid, I always thought Bela Lugosi was scary. But it's a very entertaining movie. Andy says that I thought the remake of Willard was not scary. I actually like the remake of Willard with Crispin Glover. I liked it. All right, here are some more terrible ones. Right around from the same time period, there were a lot of bad movies. There were a lot of bad horror movies in the mid-2000s. Cursed, a Wes Craven's terrible werewolf movie with Christina Ricci, Jesse Eisenberg, Judy Gear, Joshua Jackson, Shannon Elizabeth. House of Wax remake from 2005 as well with Elisha Cuthbert. Another terrible, terrible movie. How about Fear.com with Stephen Dorff? And this was one of the first movies to make the internet horrifying. Well, not horrifying, but, you know, they tried. Warlock from 1989 with Julian Sands. Yeah, I remember not liking the movie, but I thought it was funny. Because it wasn't very good, but I thought there was some funny stuff in it. Urban Legend from 1998 with Alicia Witt, Jared Leto, Tara Reid, Christopher Plummer. What the hell is Christopher Plummer doing in it? Oh, here's one. The Boogeyman from 1980. I actually thought this movie was a little creepy when I was younger. It came out in 1980, so I was 15. But I actually thought it was a little creepy. Director Uli Lamell is a hack who rips off the best elements of Halloween, The Exorcist, and the Amityville Horror and still fails to generate more scares than snores. How about Maximum Overdrive? Stephen King's only directorial credit with Emilio Estevez, Pat Hingle. That's where all the machines attack everybody. It's based on his short story Trucks with a soundtrack by AC/DC. It's a terrible movie, and he'll admit it too. Stephen King will happily admit that Maximum Overdrive is an awful movie. Anaconda. Come on, Anaconda's awesome. Anaconda's awesome.
Yeah, what's not to like about that one?
It's not. I mean, if they're saying it's not scary, it's not scary, but it's awesome.
Yeah.
If only for John Voight, man, and his ridiculous accent. Ice Cube, Eric Stoltz, Jennifer Lopez, Owen Wilson.
Yeah.
Kari Wuhr. Kari Wuhr, by the way, speaking of eight-legged freaks, Kari Wuhr is in that.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
All right. The Friday the 13th remake. The Final Destination. They put The Final Destination on here? Wow, people like that movie. And there's like 12 of them. They keep making them. Here's the thing about the Final Destination movies. They're all the same. They're all just like, how creatively can we kill a teenager?
Yeah.
How creatively can they die? That's it. The first one was whatever. It was okay. The second one, the first 10 minutes of Final Destination 2 is some of the best car stunts I've ever seen in a movie ever. It's just a massive pile up on a highway.
Yeah.
And the way it's set up, the way it's staged, the way it's executed, it's brilliant. I could watch the first and then the rest of the movie, whatever. It's the teenagers dying.
Yeah.
I could watch Final Destination, the first 10 minutes of Final Destination 2 on a reel, on just a over and over and over again on a loop. Love it. The Ring 2. Yeah, I didn't like The Ring 1. So they also include Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare, featuring my friend Lisa Zane. And that's what the one where you had to put on the 3D glasses for the last 10 minutes, because only the last 10 minutes were in 3D. And that was supposed to be the last Freddy Krueger movie. But, of course, it wasn't. But my good friend Lisa Zane did get to kill Robert Englund. Survival of the Dead, George A. Romero. I think you've been a little harsh. You can't put a George Romero movie on this kind of list. Now, granted, Survival of the Dead is absolutely the weakest of his zombie movies, of his dead movies, but it's still got great stuff in it. It's not perfect, but it's got great stuff in it. Wes Craven's Deadly Friend comes in next. Deadly Friend is known for one thing. It's a terrible movie. These guys bring a dead girl back to life by making her a robot, and she's played by Christy Swanson.
I remember that one.
Now, do you remember the most iconic scene in it?
The basketball.
Yes.
Oh, that's
it's fantastic.
It's awesome.
Christy Swanson whips a basketball at Ann Ramsey's face, and her head explodes. Like, literally, yeah. Her head explodes. It's great. It's not a good movie. I would be the first to admit it. But just that scene alone,
yeah.
You know, with the basketball exploding, Ann Ramsey's head. Throw Mama from the train. Yeah. Ann Ramsey, her head explodes because Christy Swanson, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, whips a basketball at her head.
I just love, like, because of when it was done and the, you know, type of effects involved. You know, she's still moving around, and you can tell somebody's hiding underneath the dress.
It's really, seriously. I remember I've only seen Deadly Friend in the theater once because it's not very good. But when it's on cable or whatever, mm-hmm. I always watch that scene online. You could watch the basketball scene from Deadly Friend online, and I suggest you do it because it's absolutely classic and hilarious. But I remember I was at the Norwich Theater with a couple of buddies, and we were seeing Deadly Friend. And when that scene happened, the place went up for grabs. Place went up. Everybody went nuts in the theater when Ann Ramsey's head exploded because of a basketball. Genius. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll wrap this up. We'll talk more about some of the least scary movies of all time. And then we're going to jump into, after the 3:30 news, we are going to jump into some sketch comedy. The Washington Post put together a really interesting and great piece where they went through some of the most important and greatest pieces of sketch comedy that have been done in different shows. So we'll jump into that. And we want to hear from you about sketch comedy at 312-981-7200.
Her name was Lola.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN. Thankfully, that's the last of the triple play of Barry Manilow, so we can move on to something else in a little bit. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Triple play Thursday. Yeah, mate, triple play Thursday. If you want to jump in. And we're wrapping it up here about the least scary movies, bad movies, disappointing horror films. Coming in here now is the remake of 13 Ghosts, which was so horrendous.
Oh, yeah.
Tony Shalhoub, Matthew Lillard. For some reason, F. Murray Abraham is in it. It was so terrible. And the original 13 Ghosts, the William Castle movie, which Rich showed a few weeks ago on Svengoolie, is so great and campy and ridiculous and just really a lot of fun. But this, I remember sitting in the theater. This came out like almost 20 years ago, this version of 13 Ghosts. I remember just sitting in the theater like, what the hell am I watching here?
Yeah.
They include Wolf, directed by Mike Nichols, which is a movie that one of the few Mike Nichols movies that I actually hate. Because the majority of Mike Nichols movies are either really good or great. But this is, I think it's my least favorite Mike Nichols movie. It's Jack Nicholson turns into a wolf. James Spader's in it. Michelle Pfeiffer. It just seemed like Mike Nichols, and God bless him, I love the guy, but Mike Nichols didn't respect the genre. Like he was quietly mocking horror movies. Like, look how stupid this genre is within making one. Next is The Wicker Man, the remake with Nicolas Cage, which of course is a notoriously, incredibly, hilariously stupid movie with, you know, the whole bees thing. And that, I mean, it's just, it is Nicolas Cage at the possible worst. And it's still one of these, he's running around in a bear suit punching women in the face. And it's also the remake of a movie that's really good. Like, the original Wicker Man is a very good movie and a creepy one. Let's see. Final Exam from 1981. Yeah, I remember seeing that one at the Plaza Theater in Lincolnwood, and the audience booed at the end. Silent Night, Deadly Night Part 2, which only contains about 40 minutes of actual new footage, and the rest are flashbacks from the first movie. Leprechaun is mentioned here. The Hills Have Eyes Part 2, Wes Craven directed that. My favorite thing in the movie is that it's a terrible... Hills Have Eyes Part 2 is terrible. My favorite thing in the movie, though, is that, like, everybody... The movie consists, like we just mentioned of another movie, consists of a lot of flashbacks. Like, the story is told through an excessive amount of flashbacks. To the point where, like, almost every character gets a flashback. And then at one point... The family dog gets a flashback. So I was like, all right, yeah. Family dog gets a flashback. Let's see. The Mangler is mentioned, the remake of Prom Night. Jaws the Revenge, that's the one, the notorious one, the Jaws movie where the shark now is taking it personally. Halloween Resurrection. Where they kill off Jamie Lee Curtis. And then the remake of The Haunting, which was, again, a terrible idea. Jan de Bont directed that. And then number one here on the list is House of the Dead. Again, Uwe Boll, based on a video game. Those are it. We got some text here. 724 area code says, The Prowler was one of the best cheesy slasher flicks ever. I like The Prowler, and The Prowler contains... And again, it's another one of these movies that came out, you know, where every week at least two stupid slasher movies were released back when I was in high school and in the 80s. But the Prowler was pretty well made. It was stupid. You know, it was your basic dumb slasher movie. I will fully admit that. But it had Tom Savini special effects, which were really, really good. And it had some genuinely sort of creepy moments. 708, how about The Howling 2? The Howling 2, this is the only thing I remember about The Howling 2. Sybil Danning is in The Howling 2. A very sexy, voluptuous woman. And she had a tendency to wear very skimpy outfits, and she had big breasts, and she had a tendency to take those outfits off in movies. And in The Howling 2, she has this sort of legendary topless scene where she's screaming and she rips off her top. In the scene, and then during the end credits, so she does it in the movie, and of course, you know, everybody in the theater goes, well, Sybil Danning, good for you. And in the end credits, they put it on a loop and they just repeat it over and over again of her just ripping her ripping the top off. I'm not making this up, because they knew that the best thing in the movie was that. So during end credits, to have people sit through the end credits, they just repeated the scene over and over again of Sybil Danning ripping her top off.
And that's marketing at its finest, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, oh, man.
815 area code. Nothing will make you more paranoid being around everything than binge-watching all five Final Destination movies. Why would you do that to yourself? 773 area code. Nick, I happen to like Barry Manilow. We can't all like rock music. Hey, I like a lot more than rock music. I just think Barry Manilow sucks. That's all. And I like a lot more than rock music. I happen to think the Carpenters and Karen Carpenter sang like an angel. I could listen to the Carpenters all day long. That's as far from rock as you can get. But I hate Barry Manilow. I thought none of the Nightmare on Elm Streets were scary. That's why I could watch them. Horror movies scare me. Okay. Well, the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, except for the first one and New Nightmare, are both scary. Those are the only ones directed by Wes Craven. The first one and New Nightmare. Okay. Those are both scary. The rest of them, Freddy turns into like a jokey joke guy, you know, yeah, making smart ass comments after he kills people and saying puns and stuff. He was a genuinely scary villain in the first one, and he gets scary again in New Nightmare. 630 area code says Blood Beach, so awful. It was unintentionally funny. And then 262 area code says Frankenhooker. I happen to love Frankenhooker. So, all right. We got a break here for some news, and then we're going to come back and we're going to talk sketch comedy. What do you think are the best sketch comedy sketches of all time? All right, the news is up after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Again, we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 o'clock. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, Steve Cochran at 6, and I'll join Steve and the gang at 6:20 for my weekly Thursday visit where we'll talk about some entertainment stuff and some movies. I always love being a part of Steve Cochran's show, and we'll do that at 6:20 this morning. So we're back, and we're going to jump into the world of sketch comedy. And as you guys know, I happen to really love sketch comedy. It's one of my favorite things in the world. I studied at Second City. I have been watching SNL since the beginning. I worshipped SCTV, a lot of the sketch comedy that's out now. So somebody that I love, and I wanted to talk about your favorite sketches. What do you think are some of the best sketches in the history of sketch comedy? Not just SNL, but any other show that features the world of sketch comedy. Washington Post, an author, wrote a piece on this very idea, and took the last 20 years. So one of the reasons why stuff like SCTV is not on it is because SCTV doesn't exist in the last 20 years. They've been gone, and that's why Python's not on it, because Python hasn't existed. And but some of the greatest sketches ever have appeared on SCTV and of course on Python. But for this article, they're going back only 20 years, so basically to the beginning of, to the end of 99. But for our conversation, for the sake of our conversation, we can go back and talk about, go back as far as you want in sketch comedy and talk about what you think are the funniest and what you think are the most important. But for this article, it's only 20 years. So we'll talk about that article and we'll talk about more. And the phone lines are open right now. We're talking sketch comedy. What do you think are the most important and the best? 312-981-7200. Here's the introduction to this piece that it's in the Washington Post. By the way, if you want to read this whole piece, as you should be liking our Facebook page. That's what you need to do. All of the stuff that we talk about on the show is posted up on the Facebook page. You can read it all there at length and leave comments and do all that cool stuff. So like us right now. Follow us right now. Facebook.com/Nick D Show. Here's the article, what they say. Sketch comedy has changed a lot since its vaudeville days. Once confined to a stage, sketches unleashed themselves on our big glowing boxes, which would be TVs, before lying in wait on the internet, ready to be summoned at any moment to our small glowing rectangles, our phones. The past two decades have been especially defining for the medium, the internet, social media, politics, social mores, and public discourse on race and gender have altered dramatically. Sketch comedy has not only reflected that, but has also propelled these changes forward. I, the author, set out to make a list of 20 defining sketches that capture this sea of change starting in the year 2000. For this purpose of the list, defining does not mean the best sketches or even objectively the funniest. What we find funny rapidly evolves. Not all jokes can stand the test of time. Defining can be a nebulous descriptor, but let's try to give some form to it. Which sketches help alter sketch comedy itself? Which exemplified or popularized a certain comedic sensibility? What permeated our shared psyche or charted a new way through changing media? To qualify, here are some of the ground rules. Sketches had to involve characters in a short vignette that was written and plotted out rather than improvised. They must have been televised. They had to come from American shows. The final list, which in no particular order includes sketches you've seen, ones you haven't, and a lot of SNL, the natural outcome of being the longest-running and most widely watched sketch series ever. Throughout comedy's evolution, sketches have been a prominent place within our culture. They can still give us a new shared laugh for the mundane. They can allow us to process the serious or painful aspects of our existence, or they can simply just make us laugh. So that's the criteria that this author put together in the Washington Post. So it's just from the last 20 years. And again, a lot's happened in the world, as was mentioned. And these are the sketches that kind of represent what has happened in the past 20 years, in our world. So the first one the author mentions is More Cowbell, which of course has become an absolutely legendary sketch. I will never forget the first time I saw More Cowbell. I watched it live the night it aired, it just became this. It became this thing, and Christopher Walken has won an Academy Award. He's been in some of the most critically acclaimed movies. He's got a 45-year career. And when he walks down the street, all he hears is more cowbell. They scream
he
more
won
cowbell.
An award for that sketch, didn't he?
I think he did. Oh, I don't know. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to look this
up. But that was a very memorable episode. Walken was obviously the host, and they had a lot. They had a, not only was the cowbell sketch on there, but the census sketch was on there. That's when Tim Meadows was going door to door doing a census, and he talks about he goes to Christopher Walken's door, knocks on his door, and tries to ask him some very simple census questions, and the result is absolutely hilarious. But here's how they explain the cowbell sketch. If we had to explain to future generations how this thing, how things went viral before the word was associated with anything but a contagious disease, we might want to point to this 2000 SNL sketch about Blue Oyster Cult's Don't Fear the Reaper. It's very weird and non-topical, but it somehow managed to infect us all. For years after, its legacy followed around the real-life band who had to deal with fans at the show yelling for more cowbell. Will Ferrell's physical comedy, his too small shirt creeping up his belly while he struck his humble instrument, and Christopher Walken-esque delivery, which may have sold the sketch. However, two lines in particular, I need more cowbell and I got a fever and the only prescription is more cowbell, took over our brains and still hasn't let go. Somehow we all knew to laugh at this, tell each other about it, and repeat the lines over and over again, and in the digital public square of Facebook and Twitter. The other thing about the sketch, one of the reasons why that sketch works so beautifully is because when Walken hosts the show, first of all, obviously we all know Walken's nuts. And he's really good at playing crazy, off-kilter characters that don't seem to be in the same universe as us. And that's one of the reasons why he's so funny on SNL, is because he's totally into the teleprompter. Like, he looks at the cue cards, makes no apology for it. Which is why The Continental is so funny, because he's looking right directly into the camera and reading the cue cards. And that's just what he does. The reason why the cowbell thing has this sort of weird qualities because Walken doesn't know that the other guys are losing it, because everybody on that stage except for Chris Parnell's the only one who doesn't break.
Yeah,
everybody
yeah.
else breaks. Everybody, of course, Jimmy Fallon breaks.
Oh man, he's the best one to watch.
So they all are breaking, but Walken is dedicated. Like, he doesn't know that everybody's laughing. He's looking at the cue cards. He's reading. You know, like the whole I got a fever. The only cure is more cowbell. The only prescription is more cowbell. Like, he delivers that just straight, like he was way into it. Does not know, because he's looking at the cue cards, does not know that these guys have lost it. And one of the reasons why the audience is laughing so hard is because everybody's breaking on stage. So there's that magical thing about, like, watching people break on live TV, which I think is inherently funny.
Oh, yeah.
A sketch that's weird and also funny, Will Ferrell in that shirt, and then Walken on another planet. And that's one of the reasons why that thing, it all combined to this weird, like, thing that I remember watching it live, just, like, on my couch, losing it. But I have to say, as much as I love that sketch, I like the census taker sketch more. I think the census taker sketch is funnier. I think that where Tim Meadows is trying to ask simple questions to Christopher Walken, and he lives with a bobcat who's his wife. It was a real strong episode that night. The first one they mention, obviously, if you're going back 20 years, you got to mention cowbell.
I love any sketch that Will Ferrell loses it in.
Yeah. Well, Will Ferrell, there's a sketch that Will Ferrell does where he's a doctor, and Parnell and Molly Shannon come in to check on their baby who's been hospitalized, and he, like, loses the baby. And at one point, Tim Meadows comes in as Dr. Poop and does the robot. I can't help your child, but I can do the robot. He does the robot, and he goes, that'll be $5,000. And he walks out. And when Tim Meadows walks out, Farrell's gone, and he makes Molly Shannon bust. And so they're laughing. Again, Parnell not laughing. Parnell, I will say this about Parnell. I love the guy. Never broke, you know. He was like Phil Hartman in that regard. Like Phil Hartman, that's why they called Phil Hartman the glue, because he never broke on stage.
Yeah,
never.
Yeah.
Not even. And this is the legendary one. Not even when Chris Farley threw himself through the table.
Yep.
He's the only one on stage who didn't break.
Yep.
And everybody, nobody on that stage knew he was going to do that. Knew that Farley, only Farley and a stagehand knew that he was going to jump through the table. And when it happened, everybody lost it except for Phil Hartman, because he's a pro. Okay, we got a break, and we're going, you know, we can go back a ways, too, but this article is strictly about 20 years' worth of sketches, and there are a lot of great ones on here. What are your favorite sketches in sketch comedy history? 312-981-7200. And if you want to jump in on this, the view that this article is taking, what do you think are the most important ones in the initial ones from 20 years? All right. Let's give you some weather here. The weather forecast from the WGN Chicago Weather Center. Today, chilly with periods of sun possible and some sprinkles, highs in the low 50s. For tomorrow, mostly sunny, a light wind. Temperatures will reach the low to mid 50s. For Saturday, cloudy, chance of showers late in the day. And for Sunday, partly to mostly sunny, a high in the upper 50s. Monday, a few sprinkles are possible, and then temperatures will near 50 degrees. It's currently 43 at O'Hare. It's 46 at Midway, 46 at the lakefront. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, more sketch comedy talk right here on 720 WGN.
Round, round, get around, I get around. Yeah, get around, round, round, I get around. I get around.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, I forgot to ask who requested the Beach Boys.
That was Tim from Indiana.
Tim from Indiana.
He had enough of Barry Manilow, and he wanted something that would make people happy.
There you go. All right, so there's the Beach Boys. And it is Triple Play Thursday, and I am Nick DiGilio. A really pretty cool article in the Washington Post, which is linked up on our Facebook page. You can check it out there at facebook.com/NickDShow. The author takes a look back at 20 years worth of sketch comedy and how this world has changed and how we consume culture has changed, and looks at what are some of the more definitive sketch comedies, pieces of sketch comedy that that we've been watching over the past 20 years. But I've opened it up to, a sketch comedy of all time. What are some of your favorite sketches? That's what we're talking about now. And the news, by the way, is next in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here on WGN. All right, let's see. Here's Steve on WGN. Hi, Steve. Steve?
Yeah. The Bob and Doug McKenzie.
Right.
On SCTV, Moranis and Thomas were just fabulous on that.
Yes, they were.
I don't want to delve into SNL, but also every Conway and Corman sketch.
Right, on Carol Burnett.
Yeah, those were classic.
Yeah, those are great. And we've got a lot of texts coming in. People are talking about Tim Conway on the Carol Burnett show with Harvey Korman and as the dentist, where Tim Conway plays the dentist.
Oh, that was
that's the
one
that everyone brings up. All right, thanks, Steve.
All right,
take care. Yeah, the Bob and Doug McKenzie, man. Those were great, and those were great sketches, and they made a great movie. Strange Brew is a hilarious movie.
I love Strange
Brew. And the fact that they got Max von Sydow to star in it, I just,
yeah,
you know. This guy was Bergman's go-to actor, and he's in Strange Brew. Let's see. Mark the Breadman said, I was a huge fan of Mad TV, and my favorite sketch was Will Sasso playing Steven Seagal. He made me laugh out loud every time. 815 area code says, my favorite sketch comedy was the synchronized swimming from SNL with Martin Short and Harry Shearer.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not a strong swimmer. 773 area code says, anything Monty Python? 708 area code says, I loved Homie the Clown on In Living Color. 773 area code, Faulty Towers. That's not sketch comedy.
Yeah, that was.
It's not sketch comedy.
It's a sitcom, right?
Yeah. It's a half an hour sitcom, and that's just a scene from a sitcom, so it doesn't fit in. But I'm not saying it's not funny, because Faulty Towers is one of the greatest things ever existed in the world. Monty Python, The Minister of Silly Walks, from Bakery Guy. I mean, I can't. It would be hard for me to narrow it down to like 90 Monty Python sketches. I mean, it's just those guys were so brilliant and so funny, and, you know, pushing the boundaries of TV at that time in the late 60s, like nobody was doing.
Mm-hmm.
So the next one that they mention in the article is a real important one, especially if you're looking back at 20 years and how we're going to look at the change in time and technology. The next one they mention again is from SNL, and it's Lazy Sunday. This is 2005, it was the second of, this is the season that they hired Andy Samberg. And Andy Samberg brought along his two cohorts from Lonely Island, Jorma Taccone and Akiva Schaffer. And they are known as Lonely Island. And they brought the digital short to life on SNL. This was in the mid-2000s. This was right before YouTube started to take off. This is the only time we would watch SNL on Saturday night or on our DVR at that time. But it was not the way it is now, because a lot of people watch SNL. They catch up with it on Monday morning in their office on YouTube, watching all the sketches that have been posted and they're posted almost immediately after the show. This thing was a lot different. For people who don't remember it, it's Andy Samberg and Chris Parnell, and they're going to see the Chronicles of Narnia on a Sunday, and they do it hardcore rap style. And it immediately took off, like immediately.
That thing
blew up. Yeah. It was the first viral video, and I think you could narrow it down to maybe two or three videos that would be included among this one that put YouTube on the map, that made YouTube a go-to thing, because people were spreading it like wildfire. So this was one of the very, very first things that spread like crazy on social media after it was aired on TV. And, of course, it's hilarious.
Yeah.
It's absolutely hilarious, and it still holds up today. And that was only the second digital short. The first one was called Lettuce. The first one was with Bill Hader and Andy Samberg sitting on a stoop in New York talking about life while each of them eating a head of lettuce like it's an apple. And it was very, very funny. But that was the first one. Lazy Sunday was the second one. And by that point, then that's when the digital shorts just took off.
Yeah.
My favorite digital short of all time is still I Threw It on the Ground.
Oh,
my God. That is absolutely my favorite of all of them. Okay, next. This is an unbelievable one too. This is mentioned, you know, as part of the last 20 years. Frontline Clayton Bigsby from Chappelle's Show. It's about the leader of the KKK who does not know he's white because he's blind. This sketch is, if you've not seen this sketch, it is absolutely brilliant. It's another one that spread like wildfire on the internet. This is from 2003, so it was a couple of years before Lazy Sunday, but people were talking about this thing constantly. And I think Comedy Central showed that sketch, or particularly that episode, more than any. And when they did Best of Chappelle's Show, they would show it constantly. But this was the sketch. I mean, this was really... This was at the core of what they did, what Dave Chappelle and those guys did, and how important that show was, and how groundbreaking it was, and it led the way for guys like Key and Peele to continue that tradition, and in fact, Key and Peele's show was structured exactly like Dave Chappelle's show, them on stage live in front of an audience talking, telling jokes, and then go to sketch, and then come back, and that's exactly how Key and Peele was set up. So he opened the door for Key and Peele. I think Key and Peele kicked the door down, quite frankly.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, I love Dave Chappelle, but Key and Peele, they were on another level, man. They operated on another level. And in discussing sketch comedy of the past 20 years, for me, besides SNL, the stuff that should be mentioned most is the stuff that Key and Peele did, because they were magnificent, and they were on, you know, in the last 20 years, and they were part of this social change, things that were happening and how we were consuming entertainment. At the forefront was Key and Peele, who I just think are two of the most brilliant men that have ever done sketch comedy, and their show was just absolutely genius. Like, what about stuff like Obama's anger translator? But how can you not, how is that not, I mean, that's completely, like, genius.
Yeah.
It's genius. Yeah. So, more in Key and Peele will be mentioned. There's no question about it. More Key and Peele will be mentioned for the past 20 years. But if you want to get into sketch comedy in general, what are some of your favorite sketches ever? 312-981-7200. We'll continue the conversation after the news, which is coming up next. Aruba, Jamaica, ooh, I wanna take it to Bermuda, Bahama, come on, pretty mama, Key Largo, Montego,
and then we'll take it slow.
Welcome back. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. And, yeah, it is Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, be Triple Play Thursday. And if you want to jump in, it's one artist, three songs, 312-981-7200. So we are back here till 5 a.m., and Steve Grzanich follows this show at 5, Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive on a Thursday morning. We're talking about sketch comedy, a really, really good piece written in the Washington Post, which we have linked up on our Facebook page directly to it if you want to read the whole thing, is facebook.com/NickDShow. It's about analyzing sketch comedy and the essential sketch comedy of the past 20 years. So they like I said, they don't include any SCTV, no Python, any of that stuff that wasn't around 20 years ago. And they chose this to look back at the past 20 years, you know, the way that we've changed, the way technology has changed, and how we consume media and stuff like that, and society in general. And they've picked, this author has picked some, the 20 sketches that represent some of the most essential sketch comedy pieces of the past 20 years. So we're going to get back to that article, but we're talking about sketch comedy in general. And what are your favorite pieces of sketch comedy? 312-981-7200. Here's Dave on WGN. Hi, Dave.
Hey, good morning, Nick. How you doing?
All right.
So my favorite sketch comedy is with Dana Carvey on SNL, where he's playing Tom Brokaw, and I guess they're doing a pre-recording of Tom Brokaw recording how President Gerald Ford had died, and they got him singing how he died in many ridiculous fashions, including being mauled by a bobcat.
Right, right. Yeah, I remember that. I remember that sketch. Yeah.
That's one of the ones that comes to mind.
Okay, cool.
Great.
All right.
Show, Nick.
Thanks, Dave. Take care. All right. The next one that's mentioned in the article is Charlie Murphy's True Stories, Rick James, from the Dave Chappelle Show. I mean, what can you say about this sketch? It was brilliant, and it was hilarious. And this was the one, I believe, that put the Chappelle Show on the map. There's a lot of catchphrases that came out of it, meaning, I'm Rick James, bitch, which was the big one. But my favorite line in the entire sketch, because they intercut it with because it's Charlie Murphy, the late, great Charlie Murphy, Eddie Murphy's older brother, who passed away. And they did a series of these things with Charlie, because Charlie Murphy was a great storyteller. And he hung out with his brother during the height of his popularity, and experienced a lot of crazy Hollywood stuff. So Chappelle was like, let's just tell these stories and we'll reenact them. So the way it's set up is, Charlie Murphy is telling the story about how they hung out with Rick James. They used to hang out with Rick James. And so they're intercutting it with the reenactment where Chappelle is playing Rick James. And you know, and Charlie Murphy is recounting these ridiculous stories. And then it's also intercut with the real Rick James, who is used like as a talking head. My favorite line, I know the Rick James, I'm Rick James, bitch, became like the big catchphrase from it.
Yeah.
But I like when they cut to Rick James. He just goes, "The cocaine is a hell of a drug." That's my favorite line in that sketch. But I remember watching it, just like, man, that, you know, this is so funny. And then the Prince one is fantastic too.
My favorite Chappelle was Keeping It Real with Wayne Brady.
Oh my God, is Wayne Brady going to have to choke a bitch?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Man. Hilarious.
Yeah.
Hilarious. And at that time, Wayne Brady was squeaky clean. He still is, kind of. You know, but that's when you kind of realize, okay, this guy gets it. You know what I mean? He totally gets it. But yeah, no, that was hilarious. I remember watching that, and it was just so funny. Scoring drugs and stuff in an alley. Like, the last guy that you would think was Wayne Brady. It was a perfect casting. And by the way, I think he does a good job on Let's Make a Deal.
I do too.
Yeah.
I like him.
I think he does a good job on Let's Make a Deal. He's also a fantastic singer. And a great improviser, as you know, from Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, let's see. We got a bunch of texts coming in. If you guys want to jump in here, we're talking sketch comedy. What's your favorite? And we're also relaying, I'm relaying this article from the Washington Post to you, which covers only the last 20 years of sketch comedy. 608 area code says, good morning, it. Great topic. How about Abbott and Costello's Who's On First? That's a vaudeville routine that counts as a sketch. Monty Python's Dead Parrot sketch. Please. Like I said before, I would be hard pressed to narrow down to 90 sketches by Python that are brilliant.
He's a stiff.
Yeah. Kathy says best SNL sketch ever is what the hell is that? With Steve Martin and Bill Murray from October 13th, 1979. Simple but great. It's just them looking at something. The camera's on them and they're standing on the stage and they're looking at something going, what the hell is that? And then Jason in Indiana says Christopher Walken is great and more cowbell, but I think Colonel Lingus is way better. I don't think it's way better, but the thing that I love about the Colonel Lingus sketch is because it is just so, if you've not seen it, you know, if you say the name Colonel Lingus with a southern accent, it sounds like another word. It sounds like a different word. The thing that I love about that sketch is Tina Fey wrote it, and it is truly one of the dumbest sketches, like one of the simplest and like immature sketches that has ever been written on SNL. It's all about having a word, using the word, you know, cunnilingus in the most inappropriate ways, and getting laughs that way. And she wrote that sketch, and I love the fact that obviously Tina Fey is brilliant and is known for her, you know, her intelligence and her comedy. And being a really great topical writer and being a smart writer, like being truly, truly smart. But she wasn't afraid to do really dumb stuff. And that's one of the reasons why I love her so much. And Colonel Lingus is about as dumb as it gets. It's a one joke. It's a one joke sketch that goes on for like 4.5 minutes. And it's ridiculously funny. My favorite part of that sketch is that she wrote it, is that Tina Fey wrote it. I just love the fact that she wrote it.
She is such a good writer.
Well, she's fantastic. Yeah. But the thing, you know, like I'm saying, is my point is that she's got this reputation for being so intellectual and so smart and above it all. And then she wrote the Colonel Lingus sketch. All right. The next one that they talk about in the article. Oh, my God. Debbie Downer. The thing about that, the first time they did Debbie Downer sketch, Lindsay Lohan, when she still had a future, was her first time hosting when she was still awesome. And they, when they did this, cause you know, it was Horatio Sanz and Jimmy Fallon were in the sketch together. And that was usually an indication that they were going to break because that's what they did. That's all they did. They tried to make each other laugh and they would break. So during Dress, when they performed it during Dress, they broke. And they broke, you know, and they broke and the audience was in on it and they started laughing. And Rachel Dratch said to them after they did the sketch, I swear to you guys, if you break when we do this, because it was like her baby, like Debbie Downer was obviously Dratch's baby. And it's like, if you break when we do this on the show, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill you. Who breaks the first time? Dratch. And it just gets worse from there. And of course, the greatest line in that sketch is that she's gone at this point. Like, the whole table is gone. At one point, she can't get words out. Rachel Dratch is laughing so hard, she can't even get words out. And she says, well, it's official. I can't have children. And everybody, that was it. Everybody at the table. Lindsay Lohan left. She got up and walked off stage because she couldn't take it anymore. But yeah, that sketch again, that's an important one because I mean, first of all, when they did that sketch, when they repeated the character in that sketch again, without people breaking, it's still funny. Like it's still a concept of somebody trying to have a good time. There's always someone in there to tell a really depressing story and to bring everybody's mood down. And Dratch does it so well. But it was real special to watch that the first time they did that. And she thought she was going to get fired. You know, like when it was over, I mean, she thought that's the last time, you know, when they did it, she was like, that's the last time Debbie Downer's ever going to be on SNL again. Lauren's never going to let me do it again. And of course, it became a recurring character in one of her signature roles. But that first time at Disneyland, Disney World with the Lohan was just classic. Absolutely classic. All right, let's break for the weather, and then we'll come back and talk more sketch comedy. What are some of your favorite sketches? 312-981-7200, and some of the best sketches of the last 20 years. All right, here's your forecast from the WGN Chicago Weather Center. For today, chilly with periods of sun and possible sprinkles and high in the low 50s. Tomorrow, Friday, mostly sunny with some light wind. Temperatures will reach the low to mid 50s. Saturday, cloudy, chance of showers late in the day. Sunday, partly to mostly sunny, high in the upper 50s. And for Monday, a few sprinkles possible. Temperatures near 50 degrees. Going to be around 50 or a little bit lower for the next few days. It's currently 43 degrees at O'Hare. It's 46 at Midway, 46 at the lakefront. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll come back and more sketch comedy talk after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline Studio. We're here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive, and I'll be joining the Steve Cochran gang. Love being on their show. About 6:20 I'll be on for my Thursday visit. We're talking about sketch comedy and the best sketch comedy of all time, and an article that I've been reading and hooked up on our Facebook page about the best sketch comedy, the most essential sketch comedy of the past 20 years. So let me read a few more texts here, and then we'll get back to the article. 708 area code. Favorite sketch is the from SNL is the Chippendale tryouts. Yeah, with Patrick Swayze.
Oh, yeah.
And Chris Farley. A true classic, and that's one of those deals where, like, you watch Chris Farley in that sketch, and it's like, this guy doesn't care; he'll just do anything for a laugh.
Yeah,
and it's really, and there was, you know, obviously everybody knows that there was, you know, a sweetness about Chris Farley, like all of his comedy. He never really played anybody mean. He always had like this mm-hmm. wonderful sweetness about him, and you cared about this enormous guy who wanted to be a Chippendales dancer. No, that was a brilliant. That was a brilliant sketch. Chris and Roselle says, "I love Dave Chappelle." And the sketch that stands out for me was the blind KKK guy and the race draft. Yeah. Oh, now we're going back. 847 area code says Michael Richards playing with army men on Fridays. Ah, yes, Fridays. ABC's complete ripoff of Saturday Night Live. That aired in the late 70s, early 80s. And it launched the careers of, Larry David was on that show, and so was Michael Richards. That's where they met. On SNL, theater stories with Mike Myers as Cucumber Jones, especially when he staggers over his words and rotates 360 degrees in his chair, and Julia Sweeney as Dame. Sarah Kensington says Phil Hartman as Charlton Heston. Anytime he did that. Hello, when Justin Timberlake was in the noodle soup sketch, suit sketch, and also Andy Samberg as Shy Ronnie. Shy Ronnie is another great digital short, but I still say Threw It on the Ground is the best. Happy birthday to the ground! Canadian Bill says, my favorite SNL sketch like you, the census taker. The one we mentioned, the Christopher Walken census taker. Also, Massive Head Wound Harry. Massive Head Wound Harry was great. Dana Carvey is Massive Head Wound Harry, and he shows up at a party, and they've got this, you know, wig on his head that makes it look like his head is completely split open and his brains are hanging out. And at one point, a dog is brought in to like sniff and lick the wound, but the dog starts pulling on it, and Dana Carvey has to hold the wig down because the dog's going to rip the wig off of his head. Stevie Wonder and Frank Sinatra singing their version of Ebony and Ivory. Yeah, that was Eddie Murphy and Joe Piscopo.
Yeah, yeah.
Good stuff. Okay, the next one that they talk about being one of the most essential of the past 20 years, I think, is absolutely one of the best political sketches that SNL did during the campaign in 2016. It was right on the eve of the election when they did it. In fact, it was yesterday marked the third anniversary of the episode, because it's the infamous episode. Because on the same night that the Cubs won the pennant, which happened yesterday a year ago.
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry, 3 years ago. On that same night, David S. Pumpkins made his first appearance. The world was introduced to David S. Pumpkins, the ridiculous character. Any questions? Where he just danced with the two hip hop skeleton boys on the haunted elevator sketch that took kind of the world by storm. It really did, and it's a great, hilarious, unbelievably funny sketch. But the sketch that stood out for me on that same night was Black Jeopardy, where Tom Hanks played Doug, the MAGA-wearing Trump supporter. And they were doing a lot of Trump stuff and a lot of Hillary stuff at that time.
Yeah.
That was when Baldwin started his run as Trump, and so that was getting all the attention. But for all of that stuff that they were doing it every week. This was the most pointed sketch and the most brilliant political sketch that they did during that entire political season, during that entire campaign. Mm-hmm. And it was really simple setup. Sajir Zameda and Leslie Jones and Tom Hanks play contestants on Black Jeopardy. And here is Doug, this white MAGA hat wearing Trump supporter, on the show for some reason. Kenan Thompson being the host, of course. And during the course of the sketch, they start to see that they kind of agree on a lot of stuff. I thought it was I think it's as brilliant a political sketch as SNL has written in years, and it holds up. You watch it today, now you watch it in retrospect, it's a little strange to watch now, knowing what happened, because this was before the election. Yeah. When they aired this, it was before the election, so in hindsight, it's a little different to watch now. But when it aired, it was just. Because, I mean, obviously, there was a lot of tension during this campaign. There was a lot of divisiveness. There was a lot of anger. It's just it's a brilliant sketch. It's brilliant. And here's what they say about it. Making funny and unique political sketches during Trump's campaign and presidency had been a challenge. The humor was often predictable and the subject of the matter fleeting. This edition of Black Jeopardy, which aired on the eve of the 2016 presidential election, stands as one of the best examples of recent political sketch comedy. The fake game show quizzes contestants on aspects of black culture. In this version, Tom Hanks plays a rural white MAGA hat-wearing voter, and to the surprise of everyone, turns out they have a lot in common with the two black contestants on the show. The sketch managed to offer timely, funny, incisive political commentary without a single Trump impersonation, and it spawned think pieces on how voters are depicted by the media. One prominent political columnist wrote, "It had more to say about class and race than 1,000 tenderly crafted portraits on white working class." It also achieved another rare feat, and in a hyper-polarized time, both conservatives and liberals found it funny. It's a real special sketch, and it's still. If you guys have not seen it, it's on YouTube. You can go to YouTube and type in "Black Jeopardy Tom Hanks" and it pops up. It is so amazing. So all right, we're gonna break here in a couple of seconds. We got more sketch comedy to talk about. We're talking about this article that talks about sketches from the last 20 years. And if you want to jump in, one of the ones that they just mentioned here too is "Too Much Tuna" from the Kroll Show. Like starting a food truck before opening a restaurant, a comedy sketch can be manageable testing ground for a much grander pursuit. The comedy sketch to movie evolution has been done over and over again. The comedy sketch to Broadway performance to Netflix special, "Too Much Tuna" blazed that kind of path. the two characters that Nick Kroll and John Mulaney played, where they eventually would go to Broadway, where they would do Oh Hello on Broadway, and that would become a Netflix special. That was born with Too Much Tuna. And it was John Mulaney, Nick Kroll on The Kroll Show, and it was hilarious. And it changed the careers for these guys, and, you know, they ended up on Broadway, which doesn't happen very often. Like a weird sketch comedy about too much tuna on a sandwich doesn't usually lead to a Broadway hit. But that's exactly what happened in this case. So, anyway, Kroll Show, very funny stuff. Very funny. And they're responsible for some really great sketches, too. So, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're talking about sketch comedy, and we would love to hear from you guys. What are some of your favorite sketches of all time, and some from the past 20 years? And there you go. We'll get back to it right after the news, which is coming up right after this.
Mortgage interest rates are going up, and mortgage applications are going down. Their impact on the housing market at 508. I'm Steve Brzanich, the opening bell, next on 720 WGN.
Yes, that is coming up next. I will return after the news, and we'll talk more about some of the best sketches in sketch comedy history and some of the most important ones of the last 20 years, according to this article on the Washington Post. Call us, text us. We want to hear from you at 312-981-7200. Okay, let's go to the newsroom. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline Studio here until 5 a.m. I forgot to ask who requested that.
That's from Harold in Lakeview, and that group's the Messer Chups.
All right. We are back. Triple Play Thursday. Yeah! 312-981-7200 is the phone number, and we are here, and we're talking sketch comedy, a really interesting and incisive and well-written piece in the New York Post, and you can check it out on our Facebook page. You can read the whole thing on our Facebook page. Talks about the 20 most defining and important pieces of sketch comedy in the last 20 years, and chose the 20 years because a lot of things have changed in the last 20 years, obviously, and quickly, and socially, and in technology, and the way we consume things, in politics, and all that stuff. So that's why they chose to concentrate on the last 20 years in this article. But we're talking about our favorite sketch comedies of all time, our favorite sketches of all time. 312-981-7200 for talk and text, 312-981-7200. The next one they talk about here is one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life. Substitute Teacher from Key and Peele, which is truly hilarious. Both of them are. The second one is just as funny as the first one. They did two of them. For those of you who have not seen it, so many people have. Here's what they say about this sketch. It is just so brilliantly funny. This sketch, which almost became a movie, helped secure Key and Peele's place as the purveyor of outlandish yet relatable and subversive comedy. Key's Mr. Garvey, an instructor from the inner city who is a substitute teacher in an all-white classroom, is a flip of the white teacher inner city classroom trope. Mr. Garvey has trouble taking attendance with ridiculous, hard-to-pronounce names such as Aaron and Blake, which he calls Aaron and Balake. The comedy duo hadn't planned to post this sketch online for whatever reason, but it blew up when they did. The sketch is highly quotable, and having a substitute teacher is a universal experience, and it's the perfect clip to send to anyone who has one of the names that Mr. Garvey butchers. 7 years later, the humor still holds up, and Substitute Teacher stands as Comedy Central's most viewed YouTube video of all time, amassing some 175 million views and counting. Amazing. As Peele said in an interview with The Week, it's taught us about how the internet works. Yeah. You done messed up, Aaron. You want to go? You want to go to war, Balake? D-nice. It's funny every time. It's funny every single time. I'm from the inner city. Yeah. So both of the substitute teacher sketches are way high on my list of favorite sketches ever that I've ever seen. Here's another political one that they picked up. This, of course, is brilliant, too. The very first presidential debate between Al Gore and George W. Bush in 2000, where you had Daryl Hammond doing Al Gore and the hilarious Will Ferrell as George W. Bush. Yeah, this one is the one of the best political sketches they've ever done. Because, I mean, come on, strategery. That's in there. Lock, that's right. Lock box. That's in there. That it's just, it's so brilliant. Election years are SNL's bread and butter. The sketch show has a long storied history of shaping the public's perception of various political figures. Perhaps nowhere did that happen more than with George W. Bush and Al Gore, specifically with this sketch. The spoof of their presidential debate set the stage for Will Ferrell's impersonation of Bush as a dim-witted but lovable guy that many have argued made the real Bush even more likable. After it aired, cable news programs replayed the sketch over and over and over, multiplying its effect. Gore's aides reportedly showed him Daryl Hammond's portrayal to help the vice president for a second debate. A senior advisor has said the sketch hurt Gore's campaign. While the references may be dated now, the terms that the sketch birthed, including strategery and lockbox, still get bandied about in political analysis. They said it hurt Gore's campaign. Oh, unbelievably funny. All right. How about this? From Chappelle's show, we got the racial draft. Put a bird on it from Portlandia is on here. One of the clearest signs that a comedy sketch has made a dent in is when people start saying its signature line. Fred Armisen and Carrie Brownstein turned the mundane into the magical by simply slapping images of birds on various objects and proclaiming, "Put a bird on it." After this, you saw bird patterns on dresses and Portlandia references everywhere as the show became pioneer in how to make fun of distinct hipster habits. The vibe of this sketch, which aired in the show's first episode, would set the tone for how the series approached comedy, with highly specific settings and characters who seemed normal but turned out to be weird, all of whom were recognizable to you, even if you had never been to Portland and asked about the farm-raised chicken. Portlandia. Great stuff. 317 area code says, I love Eddie Murphy on SNL when he did Mr. Robinson's Neighborhood. Yeah. Also, one of my favorite, there's Eddie Murphy. Well, at that time, Eddie Murphy was kind of the only great thing on the show. He basically came in and stole the show. And he was like 18. But there are so many other ones that are great. I mean, the James Brown hot tub is spectacular. The White Like Me, where they put him in whiteface and he goes out on the New York streets and pretends to be a white guy, and he wants to see how white people are treated. That was a brilliant, brilliant piece.
Yeah, I remember that one. Yeah.
The poet who was in jail.
Oh, that's
kill right. My landlord. C-I-L-L, my landlord. There's a lot of, you can get Eddie Murphy, man. I mean, because he was he was the show back at that in those days. Anything Gumby related?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Buckwheat,
mm-hmm.
And then the death when Buckwheat gets killed. Those are all classic stuff, man. I mean, the show was not that great then, but he was. 815 area code also agrees with Black Jeopardy with Tom Hanks. Seriously, one of the best political sketches in years. Jason says Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner's 2,000-year-old man sketch is comedy gold. Yeah, under the rules that we've specified, though, that doesn't count because 90% of that is improvised. Area code. Belushi playing the Hulk at the superhero party in SNL was hilarious. That whole sketch is funny.
Oh yeah,
that whole sketch is funny, where all the superheroes are at a party, but when Belushi comes out of the bathroom, it's like, woo, don't go in there. 815 area code says the Sean Spicer sketch on SNL blasting the press. Well, you know, Melissa McCarthy, man, that was genius. That was like genius casting, Melissa McCarthy as Spicer. And the brilliant farewell of Hillary, the most political sketches on SNL were great that time. Amazing talent. Yeah. 816 area code says, Nick, anybody better than a Dan Aykroyd? Aykroyd is Tom Snyder, Jimmy Carter, the refrigerator repairman, cheeseburger, 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 two wild and crazy guys, the Bass-O-Matic, or my favorite, Fred Garvin, male prostitute. Yeah, I think Phil Hartman's better than Dan Aykroyd. Because Phil Hartman is my favorite. Yeah. He's my favorite cast member of all time. 779 sweaty balls. You can't.
That was one of my favorites.
Yeah, that was my favorite female cast member of all time. And I know that most people think I'm nuts, and most people say it's Gilda, and I love Gilda.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get me wrong. Molly Shannon is my favorite female character. It's my favorite performer on that show. Female performer of all time. I love Molly Shannon. I adore her. She's another one of these people who will do anything for a laugh, like put her body on the line. When she plays Mary Catherine Gallagher and throws herself around the stage and knocks herself through walls and stuff, it's brilliant. And her recurring characters, the Joyologist, I love it, I love it, I love it, I love it. Sally O'Malley, I'm 50! Any of those are great. My favorite one of all time, though, is the one where she's auditioning to be a stripper at the Bada Bing.
Oh,
For the guys in The Sopranos. Uh-huh.
Yep.
It's brilliant. But, she, and again, we're talking sweaty balls. You know, she and Anna Gasteyer were hilarious.
And all three of them just deadpan through the whole thing.
But that recurring sketch, though, was great.
Yeah.
A great takeoff on NPR. And just, they were very, very funny on it. So, yeah, that's some really strong stuff there. That's really, really, really strong stuff. So, all right, let's break here for some weather, and then we'll come back and we'll wrap everything up here. And if you've got some more sketch comedy that you guys want to tell about that you think is great, and we'll read a little bit more from this article about the best and most definitive stuff from the past 20 years, 312-981-7200. All right, got the forecast for today. Chilly with periods of sun and possible sprinkles, highs in low 50s. It's going to be around low 50s for most of the up until the weekend. It's going to get chilly, though. I saw the extended forecast. By Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of next week, I think we're only going to hit like 40, 41, so it's going to be pretty chilly out there. Anyway, for tomorrow, mostly sunny, light wind, temperatures will reach the low to mid 50s. For Saturday, cloudy, chance of showers late in the day, around 50 for your high. For Sunday, partly to mostly cloudy, and highs in the upper 50s. And for Monday, a few sprinkles were possible. Temperatures near 50 degrees. It's currently 43 degrees at O'Hare, 46 at Midway, 46 at the lakefront. All right, let's take a quick break here, and we'll come back, wrap up the show, and talk more sketch comedy right here on WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich is here with the opening bell at 5, and Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. And also, the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here on WGN. We've been talking about sketch comedy, some of your favorite sketches in sketch comedy history, and also a really great article that I would urge everybody to read. Written for the Washington Post, and we have it linked up on our Facebook page. It's about the 20 most definitive and important pieces of sketch comedy in the past 20 years, examining how we've changed since 2000. So 312-981-7200 is the phone number on WGN. Here is Louise on WGN. Hi, Louise.
Hi, Nick. How you doing?
All right.
It's I love your show, I gotta tell you. I've been laughing and remembering.
All right.
And also, I mean, who could forget Carol Burnett? And that time that she did the Gone with the Wind sketch.
Oh, sure.
Came down the stairs. Oh, I just saw it on the window, and yep. There they have it.
Yep. Yeah, it's a lot of Carol Burnett show has a lot of classic. A lot of classic sketches and a lot of classic. The Gone with the Wind one is one of the most classic things they ever did on the show.
I know.
Yeah,
and it's funny.
Yeah, it's really funny.
I laugh at it anytime I see it.
Yeah. All right, Louise. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay. Have a great one.
I just saw it in the window and I had to have it. A couple of other sketches that I've loved recently. I love, and I've talked about this on the show before. I love What's Up with That. With Kenan Thompson. I love that sketch from the very first time, from the very, very first time they did it. And I remember my ex-wife and I were watching it, and we were falling off of the couch laughing. And when it was over, we just kind of looked at each other and said, what was that? What the hell was that? Was that really one of the stupidest things we've ever seen and maybe one of the funniest things I've ever seen? Yeah, What's Up with That is just... Yeah, I love that Kenan Thompson, who was, you know, it took a while for Kenan Thompson to get any respect on that show.
Yeah.
But he's now the elder statesman, and he's now getting all the respect that he finally, you know, has deserved for years.
Yeah.
And he's doing great work. He's still doing great work, and he's like the go-to elder statesman. I love that. And he now holds the record for longest tenure on the show. So, yeah, he's great, and that sketch is ridiculously funny, how about the sketch, Meet Your Future Wife, and it was when Tina Fey and Amy Poehler hosted the show together, and they had these guys on the game show, and they were introducing these increasingly younger women as who their future. Who their future wives were going to be. I'm trying to remember the setup, but that's another one that Faye wrote. Tina Fey co-wrote that one. And Paul Appel, who is a great comedy writer and a really funny performer who is mostly behind the scenes on SNL, but is responsible for some of the funniest stuff that any of the women on SNL have done. Paul Appel has been a major part of that. A great writer. Let's see. 765 area code says Rick Nelson, the Twilight Zone sketch from the fall of 78 on SNL. Rick is trapped in sitcom hell as he tries to make it home for dinner. Oh, yeah, I remember that one. Max from Joliet says Martin Short and Bill Hader, the Queen's gynecologist from SNL. I remember that was a really strong, Martin Short was the host, and I remember it was a really strong show for Martin Short. Well, it's not like he's incapable because he's a brilliant performer. And 262 area code says, don't forget Kids in the Hall or even The State. Yeah, we should mention those because that's brilliant. It's brilliant sketch comedy. I love The State. Kids in the Hall are one of my favorites. I love Kids in the Hall. Mm-hmm. And just did incredible work. 773 area code where Tim Conway is explaining the conjoined elephant story on the Carol Burnett show with Dick Van Dyke, and he causes Vicki Lawrence to swear on air while he's improvising this whole ridiculous story. Okay, how about this one? Sarah Palin and Hillary Clinton addressed the nation on SNL. This is when they brought Tina Fey back because she had left the show. She was doing 30 Rock, but she had such an incredible resemblance to Sarah Palin that they brought her back. And one of the opening bits that they did was where they shared a podium, Sarah Palin and Hillary Clinton, played by Amy Poehler. And so much of comedy is about timing. When all of the stars align so perfectly, you end up with this sketch. Alaska Governor Sarah Palin and Saturday Night Live maven Tina Fey had two very different lives until they intersected in this sketch for which Fey won an Emmy. Yeah, it's uncanny that Fey is especially Palin's doppelganger, but the performance went beyond that. The sketch birthed the catchphrase, I can see Russia from my house. That was and still is misattributed to the former Republican vice presidential candidate. Yeah, they actually said, Sarah Palin said, I can see Russia from my house. And we're like, no, that was on a Saturday Night Live sketch that she didn't really say that. But what she did say was, You can actually see Russia from land here in Alaska, from an island in Alaska.
Yeah.
But she didn't say, I can see Russia from my house. the approach of this sketch showed just how to poke fun at an unconventional candidate. And this was a time when repeating a slight variation of a politician's own words in a comedy sketch was all you needed to do to make devastating fun of them. And then, obviously, Tina Fey's portrayal of Sarah Palin, you know, is legendary. So the past 20 years, there's been some great stuff and some great performers doing that stuff. But I have to say, you know, the past, 10 years, for me, it's essentially been about the best sketch comedy has been Key and Peele.
Yeah.
You know, socially and just goofy. In a goofy way. Their Les Mis, their takeoff on Les Mis is brilliant. Sexy vampire sketch is brilliant.
Yeah, I love that one.
Racist zombies, brilliant. And they're such great performers. They're both so, so funny. Oh, the writing of Gremlins 2, where they're in the boardroom. Jordan Peele comes in, starts asking people what they think ideas they should have in Gremlins 2. And, of course, I mean, obviously, Substitute Teacher and so many more things. So... All right, lots of great sketch comedy out there. Please check out the article and go to Facebook.com/Nick D Show to check out that Washington Post article. Okay, we're coming up. News is next. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be back tomorrow. All the regular Friday features and our buddy Jeff Tuckman will be here.